Blog Talk Radio.
No.
do. I'm young right now, but I won't be forever. So I'ma live it up like that's true. You might wanna roll with me too, but I don't mean to brag. But I live a life that most can only dream about, yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out, yeah. Oh yeah. Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. Let me live in it like we own it, own it, own it. To the most top of the world, what I need is you. Let me live in it like we own it, own it, own it, yeah. Never too much, so just let the drinks flow. Later on you can come through, through, come through. You know you're the prize. They should call you your highness. They call me king cause I'm that dude. All you gotta do is leave your crew. But I don't need to brag. But I live a life that most can only dream about. Yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out. Yeah. Oh yeah. Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. So we living it like we own it, own it, own it. To the most top of the world, what I need is you. So we living it like we own it, own it, own it,
treasure, that is one. season. Everything happens for a reason. Seeds born, elders die, all things in season. These days I'm just trying to get in where I squeezing. Scratch that, I bust the game open till it's bleeding. That's that, D-Don Kimasi, Mau Mau Posse, guerrilla warfare. No man will ever stop me, cause I run with tall black skinned Anunnaki, with 4 pounds of silver plated chrome in their pockets. But most days I am non-violent, just don't cut my whiz and I remain silent. And when I speak my truth weighs a ton, the scales tip as bricks of gold fall off my tongue. Your bars become stiff and cold as you succumb to the spit I hold between my molars for fun. Yeah, in all fairness, I get it from my daddy, MLK baby, raised up on the avid. All spring of ghetto life, crumbling brick and tragedy. They say that we have it good, I say that they imagining. I came from war, they were soldiers stayed in war state. Anger see through jagged teeth cause they couldn't get a warm plate. I made it out with a number two and a clean slate. A dirty conscience haunts me when I shouldn't even be awake. Cause I was born in the 80s just like my friends was. But now I'm getting texts about this for my overdose. And not that he was my closest friend, but I hold him close. He lived across the street in apartment B where they sold the dope. And yes, I'm going on a tangent. My mind is running rampant and writing is the only way I handle it. The booth is like my cell therapy. Ask goody. My words like food for the soul. Let go of the past with them. And past cathartic, this is life saving for me. 14 years old, sliced and arms with life gave up on me. But I had taken rest in De La Soul and brand new to say that hip-hop show me God is nothing short of purest truth. Show I do this to prove a point to my critics. Lyrics like fired bullets, they seeking targets to finish. My limits have been crossed. Now I've made it my business to personally master these rappers who pack shit with a ribbon. Presented to children who don't know how to tell the difference between a lie and authentic or being alive and just living. I'm here to tell you my vision with IMAX precision. My storyline is still building, the climax impending. But I am the protagonist, but I come out winning. The top is a long way from my start and humble beginnings. Finna get it like a champion, going after the pennant. Like mortgage pirates who siphon and rare gold off of your pendant. Swinging the pendulum, trying to send it back to the middle. When it's settled, I'm telling you, I'll have mastered the rhythm, 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 rhythm.
Me without a mic is like a bee without a snare. Don't you even go there. Tear into your ego. Freestyle with no rehearsal. Me without a mic is like a bee without a snare. Don't you even go there. Tear into your ego. Freestyle with no rehearsal. Don't you even go there.
High Frequency Radio. This is your host, Brother Sharif. Today is February the 11th, 2014. We are live. We are not Memorex. Welcome to the Tuesday show. We got an interesting show lined up for you. I have an interesting guest that will add to the topic of debt collection. Name of that individual is Brother James Hunt. He is the CEO and founder of Capital Credit Builders, situated and formed in the great corporate state of Atlanta, Georgia. We'll have him on roughly in about 30 minutes. The call-in number is 424-222-5250, 424-222-5250. If you have a question, comment, or concern, you can press star 1. You'll be placed in queue. High Frequency Radio Network email address. The network email address is highfrequencyblogtalk@gmail.com, highfrequencyblogtalk@gmail.com. Your host, Brother Sharif. Email address is thelawmaster44@yahoo.com, thelawmaster, T-H-E-L-A-W-M-A-S-T-E-R 44 at yahoo.com. Go ahead and take the time to mail an email to both of those addresses and be placed on a contact list. That way you'll be apprised and informed of any upcoming events, webinars, seminars, information regarding each individual's host's subject matter. Again, our call-in number is 424-222-5250. I'm going to start off as usual. First of all, I want to thank all the participants, i.e. students, that appeared at the webinar this past Saturday. We had some slight technical difficulties, but we did get off, and the webinar was powerful. The spirit was magnanimous. The participation, the questions, the information we were able to share and reciprocate was very informative. I just want to start off by offering a disclaimer to those who are not regulars to my show and to this network. I feel it necessary to put these disclaimers out so those of you who are not as savvy in this particular arena to know that the information, speakers, advice, comments, concerns that I give and any of my host guests and participants on this show is not legal advice, okay? The information I provide specifically is directional, okay? It's not intended to be legal advice, and I mean it specifically to be directional, meaning that I want to direct you to the source of information, okay, so you can obtain any information you seek and make your own determination. Okay, as you know, Brother Sharif's show, I like to empower the individual and collective. I'm not a guru. I'm not a Christ. I'm not a deity. I am just an individual and a student of life. And until I become a perfectionist in anything, I will continue to be a student, but I also will be continue to offer my experiences, my strategies, my information, my sources. And those of you that's listened to my show more than once will know that I do just that. For some listeners out there, and I do have members of the Legal Society that listen to my show, I don't want you to confuse the jargon of your society with the jargon of this society, meaning that we don't offer legal advice. We're not a legal society here. We are a family comprised of the people. And I'm here to inform the people of ways that they can handle their commercial issues with respect to the issues of debt, debt collection, and things of that nature. I'm going to go into some top news. I'll have to move quick because I have my guest coming on. He is on for a limited time only. Okay, we're going to discuss today the issue of debt, debt collection, the use of CPN numbers, building personal and corporate credit. This individual I've been knowing for a few months. Okay, Brother Sharif has teamed up with him because he was able to provide some information and plug some holes that I had in my repertoire, and I was able to do the same for him. He is a very experienced, a very successful, a very knowledgeable individual when it comes to the issue of credit, credit reports, credit reporting, credit collection, credit building, and things of that nature. He is an individual that works publicly. So I want to let all the listeners know that are into the private side of things that this show may just be a listening show for you. He will not answer any questions regards to trust and private, the private side of things. That's not what my show is about. I deal with public debt, and that's all I deal with. So just please refrain from asking questions regarding the private side and things of that nature. He will not be able to answer those questions, and I will not allow those questions to be asked. That is not what this show topic is about. I want to thank all of you for being here. First, I'd like to thank the Creator for giving me another opportunity to have life, health, strength, and the ability to come on the show and do what I do. I want to thank the Creator also for having you here today. I want to say one quick thing regarding my last show. My last show started in a manner and fashion that I didn't expect. And that issue was relating to the issue of race. I'm bringing it up again because I received an abundance of emails from, and as you know on this show, I don't talk, speak, or target a specific people. I target the people. White, black, brown, green, purple. You are one of the people, and the issues that I speak about affects all of us collectively and individually as a people. It seems as though my monologue about that topic helped to relax some of the listeners and participants that tune into this show. I received an abundance of emails from people of brown color, white color, green color, that was put at ease to be able to come on to the show, to ask questions, to be able to conversate, blend, feel comfortable in this atmosphere, being that our atmosphere on this network is predominantly, quote unquote, black. And everyone knows how I use that terminology loosely, not definitively. So I thank God that the Spirit was able, allowed me to go into that topic and to open a door to have every nationality come on this, not only this show, but this network. Because many of the topics that myself and my co-host discuss are topics that affect everyone out there. Yes, it affects some nationalities more substantively than others. I cannot deny that. But overall, when we come together as a people, we are able to share ideas, thoughts, ideologies, procedures, processes, strategies, and employ those to help all of us. And for that, I want to say thank you for the many emails. Thank you for other communities, nationalities, races, for opening up their ears. And I want you to know again that on this particular show and this network, you are welcome here. You will not be attacked. You should not feel uncomfortable. This information is something that we'd like everybody to be uplifted and blessed by. And for that, I say thank you. And I thank this network of people for maintaining their professionalism, for respecting others' cultures, for respecting others' races. The only way I would have it on this show. So thank you. Let's get on to some top news going on in the debt mortgage arena. As you know, we discuss debt and mortgage-related issues. Some of you on this call, or most of you on this call, are facing some sort of debt, or you are having intercourse in a consumer fashion. You are having intercourse in commerce. So this show is dedicated for you. Be it you're in foreclosure, and if you go back and listen to some of my previous shows, you will know the difference in foreclosure and debt collection. You will know the difference in a debt collector and a creditor. You will know the difference in a mortgagee and a lender and a debt collector. And I urge all of you that are appearing on the show for the first time to go back to the first shows and listen to those shows and get up to speed on what's going on. To all of you that participated in the webinar this weekend, you will be getting a copy of that webinar here this week, okay? So be expecting it. I thank everybody that was on that show. It was a very powerful webinar. A lot of information was given out. Spirit was definitely strong there, and the universe definitely blessed us with a lot of each other's experience that was able to uplift each other and one another. All right, let's go into some debt news. First of all, the Fourth Circuit, okay, of Appeals kind of issued an opinion in ruling against a debt collector, Absolute Collection Service Incorporated. The case is Clark versus Absolute Collection Service. And I'll just translate what that case, my opinion, was about. It was about a class action that was filed against Absolute Collection Service, a debt collector, pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692. All right? And a class action was brought against this debt collector for sending out dunning notices, and dunning notices are letters that debt collectors send out with attempts to collect a debt. I've spoke to you before and told you that they are, I don't believe there's any debt collector in this country that is able to collect a third, fourth, fifth party debt without violating some provision of your consumer protection law, specifically your Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and your Fair Credit Reporting Act, along with your state consumer protection laws. I don't think there is one. And the Fourth Circuit appears to agree with me. And they issued an opinion that I've always told you that there are certain things that they will always do that most debt collectors either don't know the law, they don't take the time to study that we put in on this network, on this show, and they will always leave you a tip, so to speak, in every correspondence they may serve upon you that will be able, that will enable you to write your own amount at the bottom of that letter. What do you mean, Brother Sharif? There will always be some violation in that letter that may have you gain at least $1,000 or more, plus your cost, plus any actual damages you might have sustained from the deceptive practices of that debt collector. And in this particular case, an attorney seen the merit in the case and brought a class action because they were sending out thousands of dunning letters. And what was in the content of those letters was, if you want to dispute the validity of that, of the debt, you must do so in writing. I've told you many times that you do not have an obligation to dispute any debt in writing. Why do you say that, Brother Sharif? Because that's not what the law says. The law says you can dispute that debt if you put a note in a bird's mouth and flew them across the Atlantic. I'm being facetious, but many times debt collectors will call you on the phone, okay? And they will say, this is so-and-so from ABC Debt Collection Company. I'm calling about a debt that you had on behalf of Sprint. This is an attempt to collect the debt. They'll give you the mini Miranda. They'll go on to justify their intent or the purpose of their call, okay? And at that point, you might not know what alleged debt they're speaking of. And the way I teach you on this particular call is, I don't care if they call you on the phone, write you by letter, or have a pretty tall woman serve you with a notice. You can dispute that debt either orally, by mouth, or writtenly. Okay? But many times the debt collector will have in their dunning notices that you must dispute the debt in writing within 30 days. This is totally untrue. And the Fourth Circuit, along with other circuits, have determined that this is actually the law, that you can dispute that debt orally, okay? So this class action that was brought in the district court, okay, in the Fourth Circuit jurisdiction, the court wound up dismissing the case in favor of the debt collector, and the appellate court came back and gave the court the business for not reading the law, for interpreting the law, which they are not allowed to do, okay, for not reading the law as it read. Understand, if you need to go to your pile of letters and need to look at those dunning letters, or if you're sending out debt validation disputes as I have taught you, and they respond or send you an initial dunning letter that says you have to dispute in writing, ding, 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 you just won $1,000. All right, let's go on to other news. Let's look at the Ohio Supreme Court. And I'm telling you, those of you that live in Ohio, that judicial system there has been one of the pioneer states in dismantling this massive theft of real property that is occurring across our country. Ohio has been one of the best states that has came out with more rulings in favor of the homeowners, the consumer, the individual, the family that I have seen in the last 7 years. Okay? Very important opinions have come out of Ohio, from foreclosure to debt collection, and now the Ohio Supreme Court has come out with another ruling, which is another big problem that is plaguing our country, is debtors' prisons. Okay? Now, you and I know that it is quite possible, and this is my opinion, that our judicial system has major defects in it. Okay? Most of these individuals render opinions that is based on their personal beliefs. Sometimes it is in conflict and contradiction of law. And many times it's in conflict and contradiction of common sense. Nonetheless, these opinions continue to come out. You're made to appeal to a higher power. The appellate court seems like they have a little bit more sense. Many times, lower court, trial courts in their lane. The Ohio Supreme Court came out with an opinion because what's happening in the black, white, brown, and green communities, for those who are less than advantaged, for those who are surviving in an economy that has been collapsed by and through the greed of the people that is placed higher than us economically. I'll just put it like that. By some of your politicians, by some of your lobbyists, and many of you have been subject to debtor's prison. What do I mean by that? I'm sure there's some of you out there that has been to, let's say, a traffic court issue, and you are unable to make your payment plan, pay those exorbitant amount of fees, okay, that is placed upon you, that is levied upon you. And many times, if you don't make those payments, or if you are not able to come up with those ridiculous amount of fees, many times they will lock you up, put you in prison. There is also going on across this country instances where debt collectors are filing complaints against consumers, and I know this firsthand. And if you owe $15,000 to a debt collector and you don't show up to court after being served, that there are judges out in this country that will hold you in contempt. I'm talking about a debt collector. I'm talking about an ABC debt collection company. You got served. You wasn't privy to the information on this show or any other show that covers this topic. And you didn't know what to do. You were scared, and you suffered from guilt that you owed this debt collector. When, if you listen to the show two times, you realize you don't owe them anything. And because you were served and didn't show up, the judge held you in contempt, put a warrant out for your arrest, and held the bond to be the same amount as what the debt collector was suing you for. I'm going to say that again. You were served within a complaint. Instead of just getting a default judgment and trying to go ahead and, you know, proceed to garnishment, the judge in certain states will hold you in contempt for not showing up, issue a warrant, and make your bond the amount that the debt collector was suing you. Okay? Whereby you were placed in prison, and let's say you owe that debt collector $15,000, allegedly, and you didn't show up to court, he held you in jail on a $15,000 bond. And you had to bond out, thereby indemnifying the debt collector with the $15,000 bond. Yes, that happens. That is called debtor's prison, and those are unconstitutional. Always has been. But because we have certain public officials and judges that are invested in the prison system, which is a pretty good racket, all right, they will easily issue an order to place you in that cage because you didn't have a court fee, you didn't have the amount of the debt, you couldn't afford the interest on it. Totally ridiculous. But the Ohio Supreme Court kind of got tired of that nonsense, got wind that some of their courts were doing this, okay? Some of their courts in the state of Ohio was doing this, that when you couldn't pay your fees, they were locking you up, which is 100% a violation of your constitutionally protected rights. Constitution didn't give you any rights. It never did. It protected your rights. Make sure you say that correctly. Okay? So the Ohio Supreme Court learned of these happenings and issued an opinion to every court in their state and basically said that debtors' prisons are not only unconstitutional, they are a cruel albatross that traps low-income people in a never-ending cycle of poverty and incarceration. I want to give thanks to the Ohio Supreme Court for doing their job and for cleaning up their state. And for those of you that are Ohio residents, nationals, or whatever you want to deem yourself, the court has, the highest court of that state has spoken to the lower court of that state and said this nonsense must stop immediately. For those of you that are not aware that you can bring suit against anyone, I don't care if it's a public official, violations of your constitutionally protected rights. It's called a Title 42 case. All right? And you need to look into those things if you've been a victim of an abusive court system, which I think most everybody has been in some regard or respects. You need to exercise those rights. When if you can't come up with $50, they want to put you in jail. Oh, just ridiculous. Let's move on. I'll get to one other form of news, and then I think my guest will be in queue any minute here. Rhode Island Supreme Court came out with a decision this week against MERS, okay, and just basically said what's commonly known, really what is common sense, is that homeowners can challenge assignments. I don't know what jurist or what level-minded individual would even say to a homeowner that is a party to a contract that if you determine by looking at that documentation that purports to allege an interest of a debt collector in your real property, and you see that that document is fabricated, forged, signed by unauthorized parties, I just don't know which one of the idiots ever made a ruling that determined that you can't challenge it. It's like almost saying someone can walk up to you and take your wallet out of your pocket, and if it happens to be a bank or debt collector or public official, you can't say a damn thing about it. For you to have a document in front of you that represents the residential stability of your family, that represents years of you paying into your personal property, real property, and you see this piece of paper that has a value in itself of about 5 cents. I don't know what a copy piece of paper costs. I know I can buy a pack of 500 for about $6. And you see that somebody took the time, although recklessly, to prepare a document that has more defects in it than one could imagine, and then a court of educated jurists tell you, you can't say anything about that. Don't worry about that. Did you pay the debt or did you not? So I don't know where these rulings start, but they went on for years, and finally you have some higher courts, appellate courts, and Supreme Court saying that, yeah, you can challenge an assignment. All right? Well, we all know that the banking industry is very powerful, and we all know that mainly anybody can almost be bought. So That's why we see such rulings as that, where they say you can't challenge it. All right? So the courts are kind of clearing that up, and you now have some rulings to defer or refer to that says that, yes, you can challenge the assignment, especially if on the face of that document it appears that it makes absolutely no sense. All right? Let's go on to some other news. Let's look at, I think I discussed last week, the fact that there has been a rash of deaths of some banking executives, mysteriously. Imagine that. And some of them have been found to have jumped off of 2 feet bridges. I'm being funny, but some of them have jumped off bridges, and one of them, I believe, shot themselves with a nail gun in an area which was very targeted, which would cause almost certain death. And I shot an air gun, and, you know, those things, they can get away from you. They have more recoil than a 357 or 45. But at any rate, some of them managed to take their lives using things of that nature. Some of them have some mysterious deaths, drug overdoses, things of that nature. And most of these executives were under some sort of investigation. And so we'll just leave that to the imagination as to why those things are occurring. I'm waiting for my guest. Well, let's go to the call line. Take a couple of questions. I have a few people up here. Maybe I can get to the questions before my guest arrives. Let's go to 469-6123. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? 469-6123. Do you have a question? All right. Let's go to Anonymous. Anonymous, your line is open. I have no phone number for you, but you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. How you doing, Sheree?
I'm doing great, brother. How are you?
Oh, great, great. Well, I got a couple questions. I'll be quick about them. One, I believe I put some in the chat room that I was waiting for a PayPal link from yourself. And
sure.
I guess
just email me after the show, and we'll send that over to you.
Okay. Well, I emailed it like a couple days ago. A couple people did. So
okay. Well, you know, I'm backed
up.
So, no, just send it to me one more time. I'm backed up. I actually
have
brought on this. No, I'm not making money, brother. Trust me. I wish I was. All right.
You can get your money.
Well, you know, if I got money out there, brother, and I'm too busy to get it, you know, it's more heart than money. But definitely email me again. I got an assistant coming on, and it'll be able to take some of that slack off of me and be able to get to these emails, although I do get to them reasonably quick. But there are some things that I need to catch up on, and I will definitely do that, brother. Did you have any question beside that?
Yeah, yes, I did. What you were saying about some of these people, if they don't get their summons, when they get summons, they don't respond to a summons, then what's happening is they're being taken to court and arrested. Some people, I don't know, they said if the summons is incorrect, the court really doesn't have jurisdiction. So should the person, when they get these summons, should they really check that summons out to make sure that summons is correct? Or sometimes you get a complaint to go to court, but you're missing the summons. The summons isn't there. So, you know, the individual runs into that. Should they really check that summons out and make sure the paperwork is correct?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you should look at every single piece of document that you get from a court or from a plaintiff or defendant. You know, you're supposed to receive both a copy of your summons and your complaint. In some cases, you'll receive the complaint from the plaintiff, and you'll receive the summons from the clerk, okay? If the plaintiff is using a process server, many times the process server may serve you with both. Many times, the court clerk will issue the summons to ensure that you were served and that they served you with a summons letting you know. They won't send you the complaint. The clerk won't. She'll just send you a summons that'll have your name and the case number saying that an action has been started against you and you need to contact the court if you haven't already been served and contact the court or visit the court with that particular case number listed and get a copy of that complaint either yourself or ensure that you were served. But that summons will be sent sometimes by the clerk to make sure that they know that there's a case there and it's your obligation to make sure you get a copy of that complaint. And if you wasn't served, you can always plead that in your motion to dismiss, alleging that you were not served properly. Process was not done properly. Okay? But The summons should have your correct name. It should have your correct address. It should be served properly. If you're an individual, can be served by certified mail or FedEx or process served. You cannot serve a corporation that way. Okay? So, yes, brother, always check your paperwork. You know, there are many procedural defects that you will find, and many of those defects, although amendable, correctable, some of them are not. And some of them can result in you having that case dismissed because certain procedures was not followed correctly.
Okay, well, the last question would be when you get some of these Dunning letters from attorneys, and they're always tacking on these attorney fees for a piece of paper sitting in a drawer. And the question would be is that attorney fees, from my understanding, can only be assessed by licensed attorneys. And when no attorney has a license, because only the state grants license, how are they able to say that you owe an attorney fee when none of them have a license?
I'm going to ask you to clarify what you mean when you say none of them have a license. What particular license?
They have a bar card from the Bar Association, but there's various cases. I think Aaron versus Simmons is a Supreme Court case that, you know, only the state can issue a license, and no state issues a license to practice law.
I want to correct you on that because I hear a lot of that going on and going around. No, they cannot license the practice of law, meaning that you cannot. And this is my belief, and this is my position, and it will always be. No one can tell you you can't practice law because everything you do in commerce is law. Contract is law. Law is contract. You always practice in law. If you call and get cable service, electric service, you are involved in having intercourse with contract and law. That's first of all. Second of all, attorneys are licensed to practice law, and they are licensed by that corporate Supreme Court of that state. Okay? That is not your practice. It's not your society. Okay? Whether they have a card or whatever they have, they are deemed appropriate to do what they do within that legal society. Now, I know many of you out there have an issue with how they are licensed, whether they have a membership card or a dues card or whatever have you. And I can give some credence to all of those arguments. But this is what I'd like to do for the people. Instead of you wanting to knock out the opposition on a technicality, why don't you just pick up the book and learn the rules and read the same book that they read and learn your rights and learn the consumer protection laws and learn the rules that apply to them? Because, as I always say, give me someone with a license and I will find several violations they will commit while having that license. I'll give you an example. You might have a license to drive a car. Let's just say it's a legitimate license, not traveling. Let's say you're in the occupation of driving. You have a license. There are plenty of times I am in my automobile and I forget to turn on a turn signal. Legally, pursuant to commerce, that's a violation. So my point is, let's stop fearing the attorneys, because I think I've shared an abundance of information on this show alone that will show you that, one, they don't abide by their own rules, and I've showed you overwhelmingly that they don't abide by the law. So why don't you just take their own rules, which is what I teach here, which is what Brother Yusef teaches on his show, which is Brother Savage teaches on his show. Why don't you take those rules, regulations, statutes, codes, ordinances, and even their own society rules, and use it against them? Wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't it be better for you to say, instead of you going into court and arguing, because you're not going to be able to get that argument through. It's a society, okay? You wouldn't be able to go to Alpha Kappa Alpha and say, hey, look, man, I don't respect your fraternity, man. All your members, man, y'all, that's a private thing. Like, I have nothing to do with that. But you're going to their frat house. You can't go to this legal society venue and start attacking the members of that venue based on their private agreement or membership rules or anything of that nature. Why don't you just learn how to beat them? Why don't you just learn how to, when they call you in there improperly or illegally, or they come after you improperly or illegally, why don't you make them pay based on your knowledge of the law, as opposed to worrying what kind of card they carry or what kind of license they have? Because you can go in court, brother, and you can go with that argument, and I respect what you're saying. You can go in there with that argument, and that jurist is going to look at you, and he's going to be like, he can speak in this venue. He's licensed by this venue. He can speak in this court. Do you have anything else besides trying to discuss something that you have no personal firsthand information about? You're not a competent fact witness as to what that attorney carries in his wallet, as to what that Supreme Court issues him. Okay? You don't know that information. All you need to know is what's in your lane, is what you can do. And if you happen to be privy to some information that determines that they are not allowed to do this or that by their own rules, then provide that evidence and use it against them. But let's stop trying to fight against, I'm not fearful of any attorney, not one. They don't know more than you. They only know what you don't study. They only know what you don't take the time to learn. You have a copy of the same contract they're enforcing against you. You haven't took the time, and I'm not speaking of you. I'm talking about the people as a whole. You haven't read the contract that they're using against you. And be honest with you, the attorneys don't have a hard job to do with most of us because we just don't read. We just don't study. We don't ask questions. And surprisingly, these attorneys look and be like, if she just would have read that assignment, or if she just would have read that Dunning notice, she could have turned this whole situation around against me. Against him, the attorney. They play Russian roulette with you every day because they know you won't read. There's no secrets. Like, everybody thinks this is a secret, you know, element to debt. It's the contract, and there's the law that governs the contract, that governs the behavior, that governs the society. That's all it is. It's just paperwork. It's either in the law library, it's either in your contract. Most of the time, it's in your contract. And then you want to research the laws that regulate debt collectors or that regulate automobile dealers or that regulates credit card industry. There's class action lawsuits everywhere, my brother, where an attorney, and this is all he does, and we give them too much credit. All he does is read the contract. When you go to an attorney, let's say you go into him about a debt collector, what are you going to take? You're going to take the letter that the debt collector sent you, right? You're going to take the contract that you executed with the debt collector, and he's going to tell you to bring all the documentation that you have. I'm going to stop there. You're hiring a professional. You're paying him thousands or hundreds of dollars, and he tells you, he don't tell you he need to go in the secret closet and pull out something. He tells you to bring the documentation that you have and you go to his office and he reads the documentation you provide to him, and then he goes in court and defends you with the documentation that you brought him, which is the contract, and the laws that apply to that contract. Now, what is he doing that's so secretive, that's so special? You're bringing him all the evidence. Well, if you would have took the time to read the evidence yourself and research yourself, you could have done two things. One, you could have been more informed when you met with that attorney, which you should be, so you can know what he needs to do and what not to do. Or you could have said, I'm not going to go to that attorney. I think I'm going to take this action for myself because I'm reading the contract. You feel what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
All right. So that's what we need to do more, and that's what I promote on this show, is individualism, self-empowerment, for you to self-sustain and be able to defend your property, your criminal case. All right? It's nothing secretive about this society. They can be beat. They're beat on a daily basis, and it's nothing for you to fear. The only advantage they have is that they went to school to be skilled, studied, and learned in their art, and you can't blame them for doing that. Now, there was a time in the beginning of the foreclosure crisis that the entire legal society was on the side of the bank because the banks is their biggest clients, their biggest customers, okay? So most of the legal society was doing foreclosure, okay? And then as things start to turn around now, the attorneys have the ability to, one, work on the side of the banks for several years, okay, and make good money. And then when the tide begins to turn, in other words, when the people begin waking up, and certain attorneys that are out there that are true, moral, and ethic, and they start to apply the right defenses and do the right things, then the ship begins to turn in favor of the homeowner. And the only thing the legal society does at that point is to switch sides, all right, and go to the homeowner's side and get your money for them to go in and do what they always knew how to do, okay? It's a numbers game. If most of the people are asleep and don't have the information, then the legal society is going to make the money where the money is. But if most of the society is awakened and they understand that it's more difficult to prosecute these cases for the bank, then they're just going to switch sides, change hats, and be like, I'm an advocate for the homeowner. Bring me your cases. You understand?
Yes, sir.
We can't blame them, brother. So just learn enough, brother, to be able to go in there and stand on your own square under your own light, and you'll prevail. I promise you. Did you have another question?
No, that was it. You answered it pretty well. And like I said, you said after the show, or I can email you right now to get that.
You can email me right now, and it'll be waiting for me after the show. Yes, sir.
All right, appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I learn every time I talk to you.
Thank you, brother. Give thanks. Appreciate you. All right, let's go to the next caller here, 302. I believe that's Delaware. 7419, 302-7419, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Peace, Brother Sharif. My name is Sharif, too.
Peace, brother.
Beautiful show. It was a beautiful show yesterday, and they cut it off and so forth, so I want to say a couple of things, just a few things on it. But first, I'm going to respond on what you just said about codes, you know, I mean, their rules and their laws and stuff, knowing what to do in the courtroom. The Supreme Court citations overrule the state court citations, and one Supreme Court citation is people are not bound by codes, rules, statutes, ordinance, or regulations. Rodriguez versus Secretary of Labor Donovan. I mean, yeah, Rodriguez versus Secretary of Labor Donovan. So on most state books, you see like Delaware code annotated, Pennsylvania state code annotated, and their codes. And they derive from the black Christian codes. So they're up out of order from the jump street when they come at you. And another thing is that, which is real deep, is that we're different from them. And species like the alligator is different from the crocodile. Our people have what you call complexion. They have pigmentation. So So we have, you know, then I'll be Elijah Muhammad says, man and mankind. So it's different while we do commerce, and I think people should educate themselves to that. Can you expound on that, please?
I appreciate it. You're kind of veering in line or in the gray area with respect to the topic, but I will say that what I teach on this show is the codes and the laws that apply to commerce and your intercourse with the commercial world. If you enter into an agreement with a banking association, okay, if you have intercourse with the lending arena, you are subject to the laws and the codes that governs that agreement. So I think you're mixing what I'm saying, which has to do more with status and which has to do with how you interface with commerce by saying, well, codes and statutes don't apply. Well, it does. Because when you enter into a credit card agreement, okay, you're entering into that agreement subject to the rules that governs that agreement. So if you're dealing with a debt collector, you can't say, unless you want to stand back and you want to say I'm private and that don't apply to me, they're going to look at the contract and they'll be like, well, did you not sign that agreement? Then what are you talking about? It doesn't apply to you. I'm teaching you how to use the code and use the law of contract and the laws that governs that contract for you to be able to offset, eliminate, dissolve, or even in many cases, turn that liability into an asset buying through violations they commit while trying to collect your debt. Now, if you want to say it don't apply to you, that contract is going to apply to you one way or the other because you executed it. If you don't want to agree with it or you want to say that that code doesn't apply to you, then, you know, they'll take you to court. If you don't show up, they'll get a judgment. And as you see, and you don't show up, you could possibly be put in debtor's prison depending on what state you are in. Or you wind up getting a judgment and a garnishment against you. And, you know, I don't know how much of a success you'll have by going into the court and saying, well, that state code doesn't apply to me. Now, I know what you're saying, but I think for most of my listeners, it kind of convolutes their thought process, and it kind of gets off the path of what I'm saying. I teach people not to fear the laws that with respects to debt, okay? Now, when you want to talk about another matter, status, criminal actions and things of that nature, you might have some standing or you might have some, you know, leeway there with what you're saying. But I'm on a whole other avenue with what you're speaking of. But I respect what you're saying.
I understand what you said clearly because, you know, I just picked up and, you know, because I didn't, yesterday I couldn't get on the line, but I understand where you're coming from, and I would really like to know about that. But the deepest part about it is what you're talking about, as you explain, it goes into degrees. You know, when you sign your name on a contract, that's different. But sometimes they got contracts where they try to force you into, and that's where the codes stuff.
That topic is more of a question and title that's geared towards our brother Yusef's show or our brother Savage's show. Here, I'm not speaking of invisible contracts or adhesion contracts. I'm talking about contracts that people actually executed and are being pursued for violations or breaches of their part of that particular contract. So I respect what you're saying. Well, I appreciate your question, brother. Let me go to the next call. God bless. All right, let's go to 317-1342. 317-1342, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
No, Islam, Brother Sharif.
Peace, bro.
Well, you already answered my question because I was going to ask you, have you gotten an email from me so I can get the information for the webinar that I asked for? But you said you was kind of backed up, so I guess I'll probably get an answer in a few because I sent it about a week ago. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, yes, you'll definitely get an answer. I'll definitely get around to all the emails.
I'm trying to think, but it is lawmaster44@yahoo.com.
TheLawmaster44@yahoo.com, yes.
Is the word the lawmaster?
Yes, sir. Maybe that's why I didn't receive it. It's a thaw on, let me say it correctly, a V lawmaster 44@yahoo.com. TheLawmaster44 44@yahoo.com.
All right, then. I'm going to send it out again then because I just said lawmaster, but it went through, so it didn't say.
There may be someone with that email. Okay, brother.
All right.
Did you have a question other than that? All right, thank you.
No, you expressed everything. I already understood that, so there's somebody else that need to ask a question. All right, peace.
Okay, brother, peace. Thank you for calling in. All right. Let's go to 330-5677. 330-5677, do you have a question?
How you doing, Brother Sheree?
Good, brother. How you doing?
Hello? Good. Another thing to go along with what you say, people want to fight stuff and read stuff, but you have to understand what words mean, looking up words.
That's right.
Black Law Dictionary. Because in Black Law Dictionary, you know what a dummy is?
Share with us, brother. Share.
One who purchases property and holds legal title for another. That's a sixth edition of Black Law Dictionary. That's a dummy.
You know what, brother? I mean, if some of us would just, man, if we would just get a Webster's Dictionary and learn some etymology, man, we would change our whole language. Our language is so distorted. We don't know how to speak. We don't know what people are saying. We use words that other people would be like, I know you didn't say that. But, you know, we do have to get dictionaries and get more into our vernacular and start knowing what words mean, because this is where the legal society takes advantage of us, because you do not know what language they're speaking, and you don't ask them to qualify what they're saying, okay? And one of the examples that I use in that is that there was a time, and I don't know exactly, I'm trying to remember exactly what President Clinton said, but it was at the time when he went through the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And he was asked a question, I don't know if it was in court or by a reporter or by someone, and he's an attorney, okay? And they asked him a question, and they said, and the key word in the question had the word is in it. And when he was asked that question, he answered it, because understand, an attorney can answer you in two different languages, okay? He can answer you in the common English language way, and he can answer you in a legalese way. So they asked President Clinton something about the scandal. I think the word was is that he focused on, and they came back to him, and he answered the question in the correct way, okay, with regards to legalese, he answered it. But they came back, and the common people, I think it was a reporter, not knowing that he speaks two languages, okay, and I'm not speaking of Spanish and English, okay, and he answered that question, and they came back. They said, well, President Clinton, you said this and that, and they asked you, you know, what is? And he says, well, what do you mean by that? And the president said, well, that all depends on what the word is. And he said that. And I don't know where I was, but people around me were looking like, is he stupid? Does he not know what the word is, what it means? I understood exactly what he was saying, because he said it all depends on what the word is. And people were looking like, oh, he's being deceptive. Oh, he's an idiot. He's acting like a butthole. But I knew exactly what he was talking about. We have to learn what language we're speaking. When we go into the courts, they are speaking a different language, period. You do not know what they're asking you. You do not know what you're saying. That's why most of the time some of you need to just hire an interpreter, i.e. an attorney, so they can translate. Many times they won't translate. They'll just speak their language to the society members of that venue, and They won't tell you what they're saying, but you think you know what they're saying. You follow me, brother? And I believe that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hello?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Okay. And
so, yes, we do need to learn language.
Do you know anything about business credits?
Yes, and let me just say to the listeners, my guy texted me while I was on the phone. He is unable to make it. He had an emergency with his child, and he will not be here today. I have him scheduled for next Tuesday. I apologize. Emergencies do happen, and as you know, some guests, you know, we have scheduling conflicts. So he will be here next week, so we'll just proceed on with questions. To which I have several of them in the queue, and we're going to roll on. But he's going to discuss the topic of business credit because that is not my lane, okay? I can speak about it, but I'm not an expert in that. I don't know how to build corporate credit, okay? I can deal with personal credit, but business is another lane that I think an expert in that particular arena should be able to talk to you about, which is why I try to bring individuals that work in that particular industry to the show so they can answer your questions a lot better than I would.
All right. My last question, so you can move on, is do you have anything on any information on mortgages and sign-up mortgages? Because in my buddy's mortgage state, you had 72 hours to dispute his mortgage. Oh, he had his house for like 17 years, so his paperwork's all like waterlogged and stuff. You have 72 hours to dispute or something on a mortgage. 17% of the people in Ohio bought their houses years ago found a way that they owned it free and clear. Some people pay with silver dollars. Some people do a counterclaim to try to settle for a third of what the house is worth.
I will say this to you. I had a group in Ohio, and I think I stopped counting how many people I was able to assist in Ohio, groups of people, because Ohio is a judicial state, meaning that they have to bring the foreclosure through the court system. And I stopped counting of how many cases we were able to get dismissed. And mainly, and I'll be honest with you, there's a group out in California that I've been aiding and helping. And, they were able to do the same when in California, as you know, is a non-judicial state. So, you know, I tell you all the time, you have to look at everything and every dynamic of the foreclosure situation, and statute of limitations is one of them. And this person had almost a $900,000 house, and the trustee was trying to do a foreclosure sale. And immediately when I seen the paperwork, I said, they can't do it. A foreclosure sale. Statute of limitations is gone by over a year. We were able to prepare one document. We looked on the website the next day. That sale was gone, taken down, nowhere to be found, game over. So when I try to inform the people, I try to tell you, like, quiet title is really a difficult thing to do because the court system is going to throw curves at you along with the banking industry and their attorneys. They're going to throw so many curveballs at you that you will have difficulty attaining it. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I'm not saying that people haven't been successful at doing it. Depending on how you do it, I have been successful at doing it. Depending on what entities are involved, whether it's been sold into the secondary market, you can obtain a quiet title action. But this, for most of the people on this call that are dealing with debt collectors, not lenders, okay, then you can use the statute of limitation along with your consumer protection laws, and you can make it sure, you can make it so that they are unable to collect on that debt, and if they cannot collect on that debt, they can't participate in any foreclosure action. First of all, they can't participate in a foreclosure action unless they're a creditor, okay? But the statute of limitation and other elements of that debt can totally bar them from doing anything, which results in you having your property, if you want to use that terminology, and I hate it, free and clear. It was always your property. It never belonged to anyone else. If you've been through the processes that I see with people regarding their real property, you were never in foreclosure, okay? You never owed a debt collector. So utilizing those things, and if you take the steps and strategies that I employ, a lot of times you'll be able to accomplish the same thing without going to the court and saying, I need to quiet my title. All right. So, you know, it's different ways of doing it. But Ohio, I don't know about the 72-hour. You know, what I know about 72 hours regarding the truth in lending, you know, there's a cooling off period, and that applies to mortgages, debt, consumer contracts, automobile loans. You have a 72-hour cooling off period, okay, where if you make a purchase, you have 72 hours to rescind that purchase, okay, till I has a three-day rule. So if that's what you're speaking of, I don't see how that would stop a foreclosure. That combined with other violations or breaches of that contract may collectively make it quite difficult to attain foreclosure or even allow you to circumvent a foreclosure. But I don't know of that particular element in and of itself, by itself, being able to prevent foreclosure.
Or do you have any information I can look up, or...
Brother, I mean, you brought me the information, so I don't know anything about it. You can look at Regulation Z and the Truth in Lending, but I don't know what you're reading, so it's hard for me to put you on the informational trail because I don't really know what you're talking about when you say a 72-hour rule that is able to you know, circumvent a foreclosure. I don't know of anything like that, and I've been around quite a long time.
Well, there's a little group that go around. You know, there's people that you can listen to, people you can't listen to.
Oh.
Listen to what they say and read through the bullshit. You know what I mean? That's what I wanted to ask. It don't make sense to me, but I wanted to ask you.
All right. Well, you know what? I appreciate you coming to me because that's what I tell people. If you want to vet some of these groups and these gurus and these processes and procedures, you do need to come to this show and just listen to the first several shows. And I think by yourself, you'll be able to come to the determination that there is no easy way to do it. There is no self-executing document that you can, you know, do yourself that will get rid of your mortgage. Maybe there is. Let me qualify that. Maybe there is, but I don't know about it, okay? Because if it is out there, I would know about it because I'm going to look into it. So meanwhile, while we're trying to figure that out and come up with that recipe, I think my lane will pretty much, you know, give you a pretty good chance at dealing with your debt collector.
Okay. That's all I need to know, brother. You know, I ain't going to hold you up. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for coming and listening, and hopefully that helps you. But always email me if you have any further questions, okay? All right, brother. Peace. All right, let's go to 407-286. 407-286. I read the first three numbers as opposed to the last four numbers. You're on high-frequency radio. Your line is open. Do you have a question?
Hey, morning, Brother Sharif. Thank you for the good information.
Thank you, brother.
Earlier on in the conversation, you were talking about there was a ruling that said that enforce the constitutional rights as when it comes to the debtor's prison.
Yes.
And you're not supposed to be going to jail for owing fines and the like. I want to know if that also applies to child support.
You know, I've been getting quite a few emails with regards to child support. Now, let me say this, because dealing with children and family is something I don't get into much. I have my personal opinions. I do believe that there are issues that we need to address as a people when it comes to family dynamics. And I think society does a good job, okay, does a great job. All right, and our media landscape does a great job dictating to you or brainwashing you as to how you should think, as to where your value should be with respects to family and children. And I believe that the child support system in itself is unconstitutional. In fact, there was a judge in Georgia several years ago. And he came up with a ruling that totally kind of obliterated the child support system as to how they were calculating child support payments, who they were having pay. And I've heard from many brothers, and I know brothers are subject to these particular courts and abuses, okay, of these courts. And I don't believe that should happen. There are some brothers out there on this topic that are quite informed. They are successful at doing what they do, however they do it. I can research those brothers and see. But I tend to stay away from that because there is responsibilities on both parts, both on the mother and the father. And I know that women use these systems to abuse the men. I know that men do their part in forcing the sisters to abuse the men, okay? But I will say that you have to, you still look into the rules, the regulations, the jurisdiction of that court, the authority of that court to do what they do. There are cases out there, I've heard some of the cases, I've read some of the cases out there that totally goes against a civil matter such as child support and what the courts are doing. There's cases out there. It takes quite a bit of study. But, you know, I'm going to talk to Brother Youssef, and who has the same feeling as I have. He tries to stay away from the child support issue because it's such a touchy subject. There are queens and mothers out there that needs the brothers in one particular fashion, and there are also queens and mothers out there that prevent interaction from the brothers and the men out there. So it's a very touchy subject, and I think I have a guest in mind that I will refer to Brother Youssef that maybe open up his mind to be able to address this issue and maybe bring the mothers and the fathers together in a way that we can avoid dealing with that court. Because the prejudices, the discrimination, the personal feelings, the ideologies, the theories of these individual jurists that sits on these benches, they vary. And I don't care what you say. If you have a particular judge that has racial undertones, he's going to sock it to a particular race. Right. If you have certain judges that have certain religious preferences, he's going to rule in favor of how he feels, how he runs his family, what he thinks. So it's so ambiguous and it's so much of a gray area that I feel what you're saying, brother, that you need some help in that arena. But what I would say is that I don't have an abundance of information other than what I would do if I was in your position, and that would be I would research the rules, the regulations, the laws, the jurisdiction, and the ability of those courts to be able to do what they do. Meanwhile, yes, and contemporaneously, I would try to engage that queen and that mother in some sort of resolve, in some sort of conversation that would bring the matter to a head without getting outside parties involved. And that's all I can say on that topic, my brother.
Okay, well, the reason I was asking was because since the court, with the Supreme Court ruling, and other states that are still institute these policies, would that be a foundation or basis?
You know what? I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. And you know what I just read regarding the Supreme Court, that yes, ruling, they geared toward court fees. Okay?
Huh.
They were specifically pointing out that certain people were being put in prison because they couldn't pay the court fees. So the court was telling the lower courts that you need to really do a financial assessment and have some alternative measure as opposed to putting people in jail because they can't come up with money to pay the fees.
Right.
They didn't speak about child support are not fees. The court deems child support as obligations. So that may be different. So, you know, I see what you're saying, and I believe in some respects that some of the issues regarding child support is a debtor prison type consequence.
That's right.
Absolutely is. I mean, if a brother can't get a job, the society has collapsed commerce, completely obliterated it, and you can't obtain gainful employment. And if you're of a certain particular race, brown, black, and even some lower class white people, and you can't be gainfully employed, then some of that is reality. Should you be put in a cell because you can't pay any obligation? My particular opinion on that, is not no, but hell no. Okay?
Exactly.
So, I mean, that does exist, brother. That's why I say it's a huge, huge problem that I think myself, Yousef, and Brother Savage should come together and try to provide some direction on that issue and see if we can have some dialogue and some intercourse on this topic and try to put our own individual opinions to the side and try to give the people some direction, you know, direction, some cautionary advice on that matter. But, yeah, I see what you're saying. I can see the connection you're kind of implying that is in debtor's prison applies to men that are put in jail that don't pay child support. I absolutely agree with you. That's my personal opinion. I absolutely agree with you. I don't think there's any merit to you putting a man in jail that can't get a job or get a job that's significant enough to be able to take care. You can't get a job if you're deemed to pay $800 a month in child support and you're forced to get a job that pays you $7 an hour and all you're going to bring home is $800. Okay?
Right.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me, and that is what's happening. Nor should I think you should be able to have a man that has another family, okay, that is married and have other obligations that you take from that family to give to the other. So it's a fine line, brother. It's very, 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 very complicated. And it's going to take interaction and it's going to take the Spirit of God and our Creator or whatever deity you praise to kind of give understanding on both sides, both male and female, on how we need to deal with that matter. And hopefully later in the near future, man, we'll be able to, you know, have that dialogue and we come out of some of our shell, some of our individual shells, and be able to kind of engage in that topic. All right?
All right. Appreciate it, Brother Sharif.
Appreciate you, brother. Love you, man.
Thank you, Jesus. Hallelujah.
All right, we're going to go to the next caller, 111-1111. You're on a high-frequency radio. Do you have a question?
Hi. I was calling to ask you a question. If you want to have a case removed from state court to federal court, do you just provide a notice to the judge, or do you need to do anything further?
Yes. When you are removing a case, now why are you removing the case and under what grounds? Is it a federal question or did you counterclaim? And within your counterclaims, you have federal issues. Why are you removing it?
Because I think there's federal issues, some mail fraud issues and things like that.
Okay. When you say mail fraud, kind of go a little bit further. And I appreciate you being surface, but say it again.
Withholding my mail.
Okay. So you're removing what kind of case from state court?
It's an injunction.
Okay. So are you the plaintiff or the defendant?
The defendant. Or really the counterclaimant.
Okay. But you're the defendant and then the counterclaimant, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what is the suit about in state court?
It's hard to explain, but what the guy,
okay.
This person, he's squatting in my home and he filed a domestic violence, restraining order against
me,
to keep me from my property. And so now I want to file a counterclaim, against that in federal court.
No, you can't do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your domestic situation is going to come under. Restraining order is going to come under civil, okay? It's a
mm-hmm.
civil action, although it has implications and remnants of a criminal matter possibly, okay? Threat
mm-hmm.
safety and things of that nature. You can't remove that to federal court. You can't necessarily counterclaim that. The only thing you can do is defend that by going to court, and if he's filed that particular petition, then he has to prove that his life is in danger and that you did what he said he did. And once you go there, the court will determine whether there is grounds for that injunction to continue to be in place. You can't remove it to federal court on a mail fraud. Let me try to piece together what I feel you're saying. This gentleman mm-hmm. is in your residence. He's squatting. Mm-hmm. For some reason, there's
that
some...
I'm a part of his family.
Sure.
And that's right. The reason why it's a domestic violence issue, where I've never met this man.
Right. Okay. So, and within that, you're saying that, okay, this gentleman is in my property, and I'm just trying to fill in holes, so don't blame me if I'm wrong. But within that situation, you're saying this gentleman is in my residence, and he might be tampering with my mail and not giving me my mail and doing that, so you want to take a charge against him for... mail tampering. First of all, the protocol for that is that you have to go to the postmaster to file that complaint, and the postmaster will investigate any tampering with mail. You do not have the ability to bring, you don't have a private right of action to bring a claim of mail tampering. That's handled by the postal community. Okay, so you can't remove that case because that's a civil case that's germane to the state, meaning that the state handles all claims of domestic issues, all right? You just need to go into that court. You need to defend your case. You can't counterclaim them. What you can do, if you feel he brought a frivolous claim and suit against you, you can look into suing him for defamation, abuse of process, abuse of litigation, things of that nature. You'll have the opportunity to cross-examine that person. You'll have an opportunity under oath, and you'll have a chance to make your case. You can take that information from that case and the appearance of him perjuring himself and ask the court to take action against him for doing so. Once you've gathered that information and the court determines that the gentleman was lying or he was not able to provide evidence supporting his claims, then you can go and file you a separate action or tort claim and say that, you know, abuse of litigation, defamation, defamation of character, and things of that nature. But you can't do a removal pursuant to USC 1441. You can't do a removal to federal court. They will absolutely kick that back, and you will look like you have no idea what you're doing. That claim is going to stand on its own.
Now, even if with this person, if I believe that he is also acting in collusion with other public officials, would I be able to file in federal court and out of the you know, the circuit court?
No, ma'am. You're going to have quite a difficult time alleging that he's colluding with public officials and things of that nature. That's going to be very difficult. And no disrespect, I'm just trying to lead you in the right direction. I don't think you're prepared to be able to engage in that type of litigation and be successful. So what you need to do,
but
ma'am,
if he is
this.
Colluding, but if he is colluding, would that be a federal issue if he's colluding with public officials?
You
would
have
that be
to
a federal
prove
issue,
that.
Or
what
would that
evidence?
Be a circuit court?
What?
I understand,
well,
but if it is an issue, would it be federal or would it be circuit court?
Now you're saying the issue, you're kind of vague. So you're saying if it's an issue where he's colluding with public officials, is it federal? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It depends on what he's colluding about. It depends on what he's doing. The protocol that society knows, what we are deemed to know, is that if we have an issue, we need to file a complaint with the appropriate governing body. So we need to file a complaint with your police department, your attorney general, your sheriff's department, or whatever have you. If you have a judicial conduct complaint, you file it with the proper judiciary. So I don't know, when you say colluding, it's real vague, and only you internally know what you're speaking of, but it sounds like you have a very difficult case trying to prove something that is in the hands of the person you're accusing. Okay? If that information is with him, how are you going to get it from him? How are you going to prove that? Do you have recordings? Do you have evidence? Do you have documentation? Those kind of things, you won't have a private right of action taken on your own. The only thing you can do is report a crime, if you've been a victim of a crime, or take civil
that,
action
but if that crime,
for some tort.
If that crime is not investigated, then I was reading somewhere, I thought, that if the crime is not investigated, then that particular public official is also engaging in that behavior as well, because they're not investigating the crime.
Okay. I know what you're talking about, but again, that is not something you have a private right of action, meaning you can't bring that action in court. You're speaking of misprison of felony. meaning if somebody is aware, a public official is aware of a crime and fails to report it, they may be liable or may be guilty of misprison of felony. What I suggest that you do, ma'am, is to seek an attorney that deals with that subject matter, file your proper complaints, get your paper trail, get your evidence. And if you're dealing with public officials, I think you should be careful on how and where you relay that information and who you relay it to, because those allegations are mere allegations. Just like the gentleman, you know, got a restraining order and may have said certain information. I don't know if it's true or not, but he has to prove that no differently than you would have to prove that he's colluding with public officials or anybody else. Okay?
Okay.
It's a difficult case. I can hear your frustration, but I think you need a lot of help. Beside what you can find on this show, I think you need to file some proper complaints, and you need to definitely not take any action on your own and see an attorney.
Okay, I understand. And one other question that I had for you also, if you want to actually get something in the official public record, what's the process to, instead of just having it filed, to actually get it recorded in the official public record?
I don't know what you mean by official public record, but public notice is you filing any notice, whether you write it by hand on a napkin or a piece of paper, in your county recorder. That is public notice. That is considered authenticated documentation once it is filed in the recorder. So I don't know publish it in a newspaper.
But
well,
not
the
with
circuit
the clerk court
of court.
You actually do it with the recorder, not necessarily with the clerk of court.
Your recorder's office. You're going to have a clerk in every court. Now, when you say clerk of court, you know, you have a clerk of court in the federal court, you have a clerk of court in the magistrate court. When you say clerk of court, that's broad. You just need to file where public notices are recorded in your county, and many times that's your county borders. All right?
Okay, great. Okay,
thank you
so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
God bless. All right, let's go to 904-5329, 904-5329, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Okay, yes, I do. Okay, I have several questions, actually. One is in reference to the tax liability on the bonds that the courts create for you when you're going to jail. I know I think it becomes a little complicated with women when we're married and we take on the spouse's last name, and then they bring something into court up under your maiden name mixed with your current name that you have now. So I'm trying to think, is there a different process that I have to go by, because I'm trying to correct my status at this time? But compared to on my birth certificate, I'm dealing with my maiden name, but I'm operating under my married name now. But the court case that I have in place now is not even the name that I'm using. That's on my identification. It's my first name, maiden name, married name that they brought to the court case. So does that make any difference with me owning the name and trying to deal with this with the name that they've brought, is my first part of that question. And the second part, in reference to the tax liability and the bond that comes into play, I've been getting a runaround between the comptrollers and the administration and the accounting department at the courts with getting the financial statement to the case, and they've confirmed that there is a trust that they put the appearance bond into, but have not raised any issues as far as trying to give me the information that I need or the copies for my qualified blind trust that they opened. So I'm trying to figure out, do I put in the 1099 for that myself to report it, but the problem still is that they're bringing a case on a name that I don't use.
Well, sister, it sounds like you. I'm glad you qualified by saying that doesn't make any sense. I'm gonna be nice, and I'm gonna say I feel that you feel that it makes sense, and I can see where some of it makes sense, but I'm going to say this. This is one of the issues that we have when we're given too much information. This is why Brother Sharif believes in giving information in part and parcels, in sections, so we can absorb, understand, and then go to the next stage. You're mixing a lot of public and private information. You're taking a lot of, and on this show, we have three different hosts, and we speak on three different topics, okay? Sometimes we speak on the same, similar topics, but you're mixing a whole lot of in private, and then you do trusting, and you said the name. Let me just say this to you. There is what there's an acronym called an AKA, okay, also known as, okay. I don't care if your driver's license, you were married, and your last name was X, but you know your maiden name was Z, and they suing you in Y that is on your driver's license. Look, if they bring an action in that name, and you get served with that name, and you know that is a name that you have used. I do not subscribe to, you know, you don't accept the name and you kind of flip around the name and throw it up three times. I don't know about any of that. I'm not saying that it's not accurate, but I will say you can play that game and the results will be you will have a judgment or you will have a warrant or you will have some sort of a penalty for not appearing when you were properly served with process about a case that you know that pertains to you. They can't keep up with name changes. I mean, you can execute a contract today with, you know, American Express in one name, change your name tomorrow, and because they brought the name that appears on the contract, you're going to say, well, I switched that name, so that doesn't apply to me. That's not going to work, okay? That name applies to you. That's your name. That is an AKA. That is a previous or former name. So you're not going to get out of any obligation by playing the name game that I know of. If there is a way to do so, my line is always open. Come on the show and let's show how one person can execute a contract in one name, change their name later or, you know, do some, you know, status correction and be absolved of any contracts they may have entered into prior to that. You have to go back and deal with the contracts you executed. And I want to stop notion in the community that doing something after you've been responsible or irresponsible of engaging in commerce, you need to go back and let's be men and women, and I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to everybody. Let's be men and women, and with the information I've shared with you, through the webinars I've taught, go back and deal with those contracts, every last one of them. You have to deal with them. They are still out there. They are still pending. They are still looking for you. They will find you. Go back, do your status correction, do all that, go into the private, do all those different things which are definitely viable to many respects. But before you do that, before you go into this dark house, this private arena and area, you got to be responsible and go handle those contracts. You got to be responsible and say, look, I was the recipient of some product, a car, a house, a credit card, a couch, a living room set, a bike, a motorcycle. Somebody lent me money. Federal Reserve notes, whatever you want to call it. Regardless, the exchange was, I give you this, you give me that, I signed that I was going to pay you this and pay you that. You have to be responsible and say that, look, if I agree to that, I have to man and woman up to that. And if I find within that contract that you have caused certain breaches or you have violated certain provisions of any consumer protection law, then I'm going to have grounds to offset some of that liability or be able to offset all of it by using the law that governs that exact contract I executed. You follow what I'm saying, sister? I do not want you out there leaving taxes out there, leaving debts out there, and saying that you can create this paperwork and go into this private realm to where you are no longer responsible for the obligations that you executed previously. You're going to find out painfully that that's not how it works. You can go into the private. You can decide, I do not want to have intercourse further with the commercial world in the manner by which I was. But you're going to be responsible one way or the other for the executed contracts that you have out there until you go back and deal with them. And a responsible person would want to go into it. It's no different than you said you're transitioning from an ex-husband to another one. You want to clear that ex-husband's name. You want to clear your maiden name. You want to clear up all those issues before you take on another husband, before you take on another situation, before you take on another contract, before you take on another relationship. Why do you want to get into those relationships thinking that you turned invisible, okay, overnight, and you think those situations are not going to arise in your new relationship or your new job or your new realm? They're going to follow you. So just use the information that I give, study, and learn how to deal with those. Even if you're lumping them into one and make a payment arrangement and say, you know what, when I executed this contract, I didn't know. I was blind. I was ignorant. I didn't read the contract. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have the information that I have now. But now that I'm responsible enough to be able to gauge in commerce, I see that I made a mistake, but I still have to be responsible for the things that I've done. So I don't, we in this community and every community must understand that we executed certain agreements, be it we were blind, deaf, dumb, whatever you want to call it, we executed these agreements, and the commercial world and the commercial courts are going to hold you liable for those agreements. You might go in there and say, I'm private now, and I've seen this. And the judge said, you know what, I'm looking at your paperwork, and you know what, absolutely, I agree with you. From the time you filed that paperwork, you did enter into another realm. But the contract I'm looking at right here was executed prior to that realm. Understand?
Most definitely. That particular question wasn't pertaining to a particular contract, but you did answer some of my other questions and gave some great information that I can use for future things. And that brings me to my next question. I don't know if someone already answered it because I tuned in a little late, but I'll go back and listen. But I want to ask just in case it was not asked. With dealing with accounts that have been charged off and then bought by a collection agency, I had raised the issue, but the institution, the banking institution that sold the account has gotten paid for that account for selling it to that debt collector, and because they charged it off, it became a credit towards them in their tax liability. So it would make them have already been paid for the benefit, which they should have sent me. They should have sent me a tax form so that I can pay the taxes on the debt. Am I right, or how does that? Because the bank says that the creditor says, well, if I want to pay the account, I have to pay the debt collector. And I say, well, I don't have a contract with the debt collector that you sold it to and got paid for it. If I'm going to settle, can I need to settle it with you? And then they say, well, we don't have the account anymore. So I'm like, that did not make sense to me. It didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now you're speaking within the context of the show. So that's a question that I can give you multiple answers for. So, and this is some of the things that I teach. So you had an account, let's say, with Sprint, and you didn't pay the bill. It was $500. Sprint then wrote the account off, closed it, charged it off, and sold it to a debt collector. The first thing I tell my students to do when a debt collector sends you a letter, say, this is a letter from ABC Debt Collection Company about your Sprint account. I'm like, are you Sprint, or are you calling on behalf of Sprint, or are you calling on behalf of yourself? Well, we are calling on behalf of ourselves. Did you purchase the debt, or are you collecting for Sprint is your question. And then once they answer that question, and it's some cases that they are calling on behalf of Sprint. That means that Sprint hired them to do the collections for them. And then most cases, they are collecting on behalf of themselves by way of a purchase of the debt. So when they say, well, we purchased the debt, my sarcastic remark is, congratulations. Appreciate you purchasing this alleged debt. Now, what debt are you speaking about? And you ask them the question, are you alleging that I owe you, Mr. Debt Collector, some money? And if so, pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692D. I need you to send that to me. I orally and verbally dispute the alleged debt. I do not recall what debt you're speaking of, and I request him to provide me with documentation, validation, and or verification of the alleged debt, and that you cease and desist calling this phone number with my permissible purpose. And that's all you need to say. So you are absolutely right. If I call the alleged original creditor and they say, nope, you don't owe us anything, then how do you owe the debt collector money? Because they said that they bought it from Sprint. Well, how much did you pay for it? When did you get it? What did you buy? Let me see the documentation supporting the fact that I owe $500. I don't recall that from Sprint. Sprint said I don't owe them any money. Sprint said that if I tried to, I couldn't pay them any money right now. So I don't know what you're talking about. You see where I'm going?
Right. They told me, the bank told me that it's in my contract that they could assign it. Or sell it, it transfers to someone else.
You cannot transfer credit card. You cannot transfer those debts. Okay? And understand, the bank can say what they want. The bank already told you we're out of it. You don't owe us anything. Can't pay us anything. Well, why can't I pay you when you, this debt originated with you? And they will be very vague. They will say, well, we don't have the account anymore. We transferred it in or sold it. So your response would be, okay, you sold it. How much did you sell it for?
Right.
This is the next trick question. If you sold it, okay, and based on your personal knowledge, not something that you would say verbally, but if you know that you left a bill with them for $500 and they said they sold the account and the debt collector is sending you a dunning notice saying that you owe $500, well, Mr. Alleged Creditor, you just told me you sold the account. How much did you sell it for? And let me ask you, when you sold it, did you credit my account for the amount of that sale? See what kind of answer.
No, they did not.
Okay, well,
no, they
I'm telling you, see what kind of answer you get.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can't, why, if you sold my account, you're saying it's mine, and you sold it for $50, I should owe you $450, shouldn't I? If I owe you anything, right? And
right.
Should I pay to a debt collector something that I don't owe them? The debt collector didn't lend you any money. They didn't provide any services to you. This is why they only pay 3 to 5 cents on the dollar, because in many cases, some of the listeners on this show listen to one or two shows, they're not going to get any of it. So on a $500 debt, if they paid 5%, they only paid $25. So $25 is worth me sending out a couple of letters and seeing if you would pay them $500 or enter into a payment plan and put $100 down and pay $20 a month for the next 2 years. They've already gotten what they paid out of it with your first payment. You see what I mean? So that's why you say to them, how can you have a financial injury? How can you claim that you were injured by my failure to pay something, the amount of $500, when you didn't pay $500 for it?
Right.
You did?
Right. Okay.
All
right. Thank you.
So you're welcome, sister. Hopefully that puts you on the informational trail, okay? And that's just cautionary advice. You know, you always ask questions, and these questions are simple. And you got the right mindset already, sister. You just need a little bit more information. What you need to do is send them a debt validation dispute and totally act like you do not know that debt exists until they have every single piece of evidence needed to get $500 out of you, and that until they can prove that you owe $500, one, and that you owe it to them, two. And I will just venture to say that if you did that investigation, you wouldn't be paying them a dime.
Right. No, I have not.
Okay.
But
just don't tell them you're not going to pay it. You got to take action when they don't do what they're supposed to do, because what's one way of doing it? Say they sent you a letter and say you owe them $500, and you call the original creditor and you say, no, you don't owe us anything. Well, we sold the account. Well, how much did you sell the account for? They're not going to tell you. But let's say, well, you know, so you didn't sell the account, and you did sell the account, and you're saying that I can't pay you. Well, if I can't pay you and you lent me the money, I'm not going to pay anybody else. I don't know who they are. So when you start asking the debt collector the proper questions, okay, pursuant to the consumer protection laws, and you start getting them to correspond with you, within that correspondence, you're going to find at least a $1,000 violation, I can promise you. So with that $1,000 violation, your second letter would be, I am in receipt of your Dunning letter, your correspondence, and demand to pay you on the alleged debt. However, your correspondence and Dunning letter doesn't comply with consumer protection law, specifically the Fair Credit Reporting Act or the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. Therefore, it appears that your letter is in conflict with those consumer protection laws. And it appears that you may be liable for $2,000 or $1,000. You follow? You see where I'm going?
Yes.
If they ask you for $500 and you show them in their letter where it's a $1,000 violation, do you need to say much more?
No, no. You know, they try to get slick and they ask you, well, when you
they're
ask them that question,
you,
if they're called.
They're not slick. Sister, you are very intelligent. You are highly intelligent. I'm not laughing. You are highly intelligent. You are asking me the right questions. If you turn around, get them on the phone, with my blessings that I'm giving you right now, and you ask those questions, you will get your own answer. You will say, now, your letter appears to violate two or three provisions of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Do you want me to take you to court and see if the court agrees with me? Now, if I told you that the debt collector paid $25 for that $500 alleged debt that you owed Sprint, do you think the debt collector wants to pay an attorney $300 to $400 an hour, possibly lose, be in court, federal court, for the next several months over a $25 debt? No, they will leave you alone.
You know, that raised a question. You know, you receive letters from attorneys now on behalf of, well, so about collecting debts and garnishing your wages and bringing lawsuits against you, things of that nature. So that will be the same method applies to them as well, to these attorneys that are sending you these letters as being debt collectors, or on saying that
attorneys are debt collectors, sister.
Attorneys are debt collectors.
If they're working for ABC Debt Collection Company, they're a debt collector. Okay? They cannot avoid the liabilities of the consumer protection laws. They are a debt collector. Okay?
Okay.
If you get jumped in the park and three people jump you, I don't care if one is a security guard and one is a grocery store clerk, they are all accomplices. Okay? They all jump you. So if a debt collector sends you a letter by and through an attorney, he's collecting for the debt collector. How can he be anything more than a debt collector? And what does that attorney know about the debt other than he's just trying to get paid, convincing you to collect? Okay?
Right.
I want you to write down this term. Write it down for me. Least sophisticated consumer. Least sophisticated consumer. This is what you are, even in your highly intellectual stage. You are intelligent in many ways. But when it comes to debt, I tell people to always play Columbo. Scratch your head, ask questions. So let me understand this. You saying that I owe you $500 on this debt, and you're a debt collector that I never executed a contract with. I never obtained any services or credit from you. And you claim that you bought or got or whatever you claim, you purchased this debt or you obtained this debt from this alleged original creditor. But I happened to call that original alleged creditor, and they said they don't have an account for me. Or you can just merely said whatever the conversation is, the results of that conversation was they claim I don't owe them a debt. So if you call me as a debt collector, you say, hey, this is ABC Debt Collection Company, and I'm calling on behalf of I'm calling about your Sprint account that you owe $500 on, and you call Sprint and they say you don't owe them no money, what's the conversation going to be like? The conversation is going to
exactly.
be like, you know what? They're going to look in the system. They're going to be like, we only paid $25 for this debt. She sent us this one letter that may subject to us to thousands of dollars in damages. And even if we lose, let's say you didn't know what the hell you were doing at all, and you just filed a small claims court case against them. Do you think they want to deal with that for $25 or $50 or $100? No. So it's just communications. This is what I'm trying to say. Ask some questions. And you can do that on the phone. I've talked to many debt collectors on the phone, and after I got off the phone with them, I didn't have to send them a letter. They were gone. Do you understand? They were gone. They didn't want to talk to me ever again. You understand? You have that ability right now with the questions that you've asked me to not only make them look stupid when they call, but then turn around and say, you know what, I know I got rid of them on that call, but I want to go after them and get some money. Because when you sue them, it's not about the debt, whether it was good or not. Because they can come in court and be like, Judge, see, Sprint, she did owe $500 to Sprint. And the judge is going to say, we're not here about whether she owed the debt or not. What the consumer protection laws is about is the manner by which you attempt to collect the debt, whether you misrepresent the debt, whether you do some deceptive act, whether you miscalculate the debt, whether you send a dunning letter that says they must dispute in writing when they're not supposed to. It's a variety of issues. We're not here to talk about the validity of the debt. We're here to talk about the actions you took in trying to collect that debt, and every judge will tell them that. So you get money for them trying. For all intents and purposes, look, you can sue them, get $1,000, and they can go try to amend their ways and try to come after you the right way, which is almost impossible. But you can get another bite at the apple. After I sue you for a couple of $1,000, try again, okay? Try again. But the information is not going to change. They can't collect from you without violating some provision of the consumer protection laws.
Okay. And now, even though that protects you from, you know, them harassing you through phone calls, trying to collect the debt, or even by mail, what in return after it has been established, I do not owe you, but they are in return hitting your credit score with saying that you owe them out here in this public record. And I've already called the credit agencies, and they say that their clients pay them, and those are the companies that report to them. And all they do is call them, ask them, do they owe you? And if they say yes, they leave it on there instead of doing an investigation. So how do we take that information, okay, I don't owe you, and make it work for us with getting it off of the credit?
Sure. And you were talking about the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and there's a dispute process that you must undergo to be able to have certain erroneous information removed. And you need to get my webinar that discusses that. In fact, the past webinar was part two of cleaning up your credit and making money while doing so, where I discuss how step by step you go about removing and or otherwise deleting erroneous information that appears on your credit report. The Consumer Protection Financial Bureau has said that 92% of information contained in consumers' credit reports are erroneous. 90%+ is erroneous. You need to get the webinar, okay? Study the FCRA, learn how to go through the dispute process, know how to send out letters, know how to set up the debt collectors so you can benefit from the intrusion into your credit file. This is where your money is. For those of you that are unemployed, and those of you that want to send emails saying that you don't have means to make income, you don't have money, the work environment is very unavailable, so to speak, okay? You don't have jobs. You have money that you can make in this consumer debt arena. There is no excuses. If you have a credit report, I can guarantee you, if you bring to me a credit report, I will show you
in your credit report where you can make anywhere from $5,000 to $100,000 or more just by what is contained in your credit bureau. If you cannot make that money, you will be able to, at that time, clean up a lot of your credit, which would increase your consumer purchasing power, which means you can be able to go out there and obtain some credit that way allow you to open up a business and stop depending on society and depending on the government and depending on your administration for providing you with the means to take care of your family. All right, sister? Hopefully I've given you some answers. I'm going to have to go to the next call.
Yeah. Yeah, where do
you
I
can just email me. Email me, thelawmaster44@yahoo.com, and just put in the email that you need the webinars on the FCRA, cleaning up your credit and making money while doing so. There is two. And once you go through those two webinars, sister, I think you'll be pretty equipped to be able to clean up those issues and even make some money while doing that.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And keep up the information. Thank you for taking an interest in your own matter, not depending on someone else. All right?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's go to 618-1858. 618-1858, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yeah, how you doing, Sharice? But I think you just answered my question. So the first two webinars you ever did, I got that from you, Seth, is about the FDCPA. Am I correct?
Yeah, when I was invited, let me just do a little esoterical demonstration of what webinars are out there. When I visited Yousef's show several months ago as a guest, I think I went all the way in on both the FDCPA and the FCRA. Subsequently, I did a webinar with Yousef that covered the FDCPA, how to do complaints. It was a almost 8-hour webinar. When I got off that webinar, Yousef and I said, bruh, I mean, you went 8 hours straight. This is the longest webinar in history. So if you get that first webinar, brother, I think I just about covered everything from A to Z. And then the second webinars, the next two webinars that I did was on the FDCPA. There was two, the second of which I just completed this weekend, that was on the FCRA, and then I did one webinar on handling court appearances, which featured our priest Elishua with the puritanical and spiritual natural law way of dealing with court. So those are the webinars that are out there.
Okay. All right. Good deal. Thanks a lot, Sharice Bay.
Okay, brother. Thank you, brother. Thanks for calling in.
All right. Peace.
All right. Peace. All right, let's go to 267-9318. 267-9318, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question? 267-9318, do you have a question? All right. Let's go to 601-2186. 601-2186, do you have a question?
Hi, Sheree. Yes, I have a question.
Hey, sister, how are you?
I'm good.
You good? You sound a little bit down. You got to be pumped up on my show. You got to. You got through. You got through to Brother Sharif. You don't sound excited. What's going on?
No, I'm tired.
Where's the energy at? Come on now. You're the thermostat of society. If our sisters don't have the energy, the brothers don't have a chance. Come on, I need some energy. Give it. Plug me in. Plug me in. What's going on?
Okay, this is what I have a friend who apparently had a garnishment judgment on medical bills. And me, myself, which I'm new to this, I didn't know that they can garnish a check for medical bills. Are you aware or do you have any knowledge of that process?
I have plenty of knowledge of that. If I share with you my knowledge, is it going to uplift your spirit today?
Yes, it will.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a bunch of knowledge. I don't care if you didn't pay your Wendy's bill when you did a drive-through and they knew your name and address and was able to serve you with a summons and complaint, and let's say you didn't show up to court or you went to the hospital and you seen the doctor and you put your name and they got a copy of your ID and you gave that physician your Social Security number, your date of birth, and they made a physical copy of your identification, you did intercourse with that particular merchant. Okay, and you left that merchant with a bill. that merchant, when they did not get paid, had one of these debt collection companies who they have an account with, that for people that don't pay or doesn't have the ability to pay, that company will come around, and they'll come around every month, and they'll say, hey, Bob, Mr. Bob in the hospital, do you have any people that didn't pay their hospital bill? And Bob will say, yep, I have 20. So, okay, well, the usual price we're going to pay, since we do a lot of business with you, we're going to give you 3 cents on the dollar, okay? So you can go ahead and take, what's your name?
Latoria.
You can take her account. She didn't pay her $500 medical bill. So what they're going to do is take that. They're going to send you a letter, okay? That letter can come from the debt collector, who many times may have an in-house legal department or an attorney or a paralegal, okay? Or that attorney may be the debt collector who is dunning you and sending you letters that, listen, you left a $500 bill with the medical facility. You didn't pay. We're giving you an opportunity to pay. If you don't, we may take legal action, or if you do not dispute that debt within 30 days, we may move forward with legal action. You don't answer, they send a lawsuit, summons and complaint. Okay? It's the only way they can obtain a judgment. They have to sue you somewhere. They could have sued you and sent the summons and complaint to your old address, okay, being that the last known address they had. Somebody might have accepted that summons and complaint, or let me just be completely honest with you, you have some crooked attorneys out there that will serve you or not serve you and act as though they served you, go through the court system, obtain a default, meaning that, judge, I served this person over here at this address. They didn't show up. I sent it certified mail. You could have not lived there. Somebody else knew you. It could have been a family member, ex-boyfriend, and they knew that you lived there. They probably signed for the notice. They probably signed for the documentation, forgot to tell you about it, or told you about it, and you said, oh, that's the hospital. I'm not going to pay it. So they went ahead and got a default, meaning that, judge, I served them. She didn't show up. And then they subsequently got a default judgment, meaning that, judge, I served them. They didn't show up. I told you that. They didn't show up. You entered a default. Now I need a default judgment. A default judgment is an order from the court saying that everything they asked for, the $500 that you didn't pay, plus interest, fees, and legal costs, meaning the cost of that attorney, $400 an hour, for him to do all that he did, so that $500 bill that you had with the hospital now may become $5,000 once he tacks on all of his legal fees. The judge issues an order because you didn't show up, you wasn't there to defend yourself, and now that attorney, that debt collector, has a judgment against you. He's going to then go and do skip tracing to find out whether you have a car, whether you have a bank account, whether you have a job, which is easily attainable. He can find out that information by a click of the mouse. And then he's going to find out where you work, and he's going to issue that judgment order from the court where the judge says, look, she owes you $5,500, and you can collect it by any means necessary, by attaching her wages, by and through garnishment, and it is legal. So he served that on your human resource department and says, hey, I got a judgment, and I understand this person works for your company. I need you to garnish their wages based on the statutory amount allowed in that state. It could be 15% of your salary. It could be 25% of your salary. It all depends. And I need you to take that 25% out her check and mail it directly to us. And that is what they're going to do. Now, what do you do when you have that situation? There's two things that you can do. You can, one, if you was not served, that means you didn't sign for that letter. That means you never received any documentation or notice that you owed the hospital, although you knew in the back of your mind you hadn't paid them. But still, regardless of whether you forgot or you knew, they have to follow protocol. They have to follow the proper procedures to notice you that there's a debt there and to give you an ample opportunity to satisfy that debt before they take action against you. So you can either go back to that court, okay, and do a form of a motion, depending on what the circumstances was. You can do a motion to have that
judgment vacated or void for whatever reason it was void or should be vacated. Or the other alternative is you can file bankruptcy, okay, seek a bankruptcy attorney or a bankruptcy preparer. If you can't afford an attorney, you can use a bankruptcy preparer. They're a lot cheaper than attorneys. If it's not complex and you just got a judgment from a debt collector, okay, make sure you know who the party is. Certain bankruptcy laws does not allow you to bankrupt student loans, certain things of that nature. Certain debts, child support, are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So it all depends on who it is. Your bankruptcy preparer will usually know what debts can be discharged or whether some portions of those debts can be discharged. With student loans, some interest can be discharged. Okay? So those are your two options, all right? And that's the only two options you have available to you if they're garnishing you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Brother Sharif, for the information.
All right,
sister. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Peace. All right, let's go to 443-5767. 443-5767, your high frequency radio. Do you have a question?
Yeah, that's fine, Brother Sharif. I want to say I enjoy your show. I did come in a little late, but I am enjoying the information that you're putting out.
Thank you.
Got a question. I'm trying to give some direction with my mother. She's up in age, and she went through she's battling a foreclosure for a year and a half. They said they were going to modify her loan. She hasn't paid anything on her mortgage for about a year and a half. I did some research. She is affiliated with Bank of America and MERS together, so I'm telling her that there's a lot to this. She's afraid of, you know, the letters that she's receiving, the intent to foreclose. They said they have her in a loan modification right now. They're giving her three options. One option is to sign her mortgage over to them, and she'd be free and clear of it. Another one would be a quick sale. And another one would be, I can't even think of the other one. But I just wanted to see if you could give me some guidance on how should we approach this. And it's really hard for me to communicate with her because of her fear that she's going through with the authorities. So I'm going to let you answer for me.
Yeah, let me say this to you, brother. First of all, I got to understand what you're going through. And let me say this to the people out there. Across party and racial lines, these debt collectors in this legal society, I've seen it all the way from probate court all the way up to mortgages and debt collection. These cowards out there, including some of the legal society, will target our elderly, our mothers and fathers of civilization, our breeders, our creators of history. They target these elderly people because of their naivety, because of their age, because of their lack of information. And they will talk these elderly into giving up their property, their money, taking over their estate. And it is absolutely horrendous. And I praise you and honor you because I've dealt with a lot of elderly clients, and I always ask the question, where are your kids? I've seen some of the most egregious forms of debt collection against our elderly, and they absolutely have no respect for the rule of law, and they have no morality or ethics in the way they go about doing it. And I always say to them, where are your kids? Where's your family? Why are you doing this alone? Why are you going through this alone? But let me tell everybody, you need to take care of your parents. You need to take care of the elderly. I don't care if they're not your parents. You need to check on the elderly in your community. okay? Mm-hmm. Your family members, and make sure they're not being targeted, all right? But let me get to your question, brother. Who is the lender that is coming after you at this point, or who is the debt collector, more than likely, that is coming after you at this point?
Bank of America.
Okay, who was the original alleged lender?
The original, I'm not sure who the original was. I'm not sure who the original was, but Bank of America is coming at it right now. And then this is over a period of, she's been in the house, I want to say 20-something years. So
she's
I don't
been
think
where 20-something years?
She's been in the house. She's been in the house 20-something years. So
that's correct. So listen to what I'm going to tell you. Your mother, who has raised you and other children, and I don't know how old you are, but she's paid into a mortgage in her property for 20-something years. Now, we know that length of mortgage loans can be anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15, but most of them are 30-year mortgages. So for 20-something years, your mother was able to pay an exorbitant amount of interest, principal, and down at the final stages when the fees of this country has collapsed our economic stability, and right in the last journey of this debt, less than the last decade, your mother is subject to lose her property not because of her own doings, more than likely, because the thieves of our society has messed up the economy so bad that we can't win, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to what we need to do about that. One of the common practices that the debt collectors will do is to offer you one. The first thing they want to do is offer you a modification, and let me tell you and everybody out there why. The reason why they want to offer a modification is not because they care about you. It's not because they want to help you stay in your property, believe it or not. Okay? The reason why they want to offer you a modification is once you have entered and executed an additional agreement, aside from the original agreement that you had with the alleged original lender, they need to get your signature on some new documentation to sort of get you to agree with them that they have some interest in your property, that they're a mortgagee, creditor, or lender of yours. And the only way they can do that is to get you to sign up for a modification. Now, they don't care if you get the modification, and in most instances, they won't even give you the mod. They just want you to sign and understand what I'm saying. They want you to apply to them, the debt collector, for some service, which is a modification, for a loan, which is a modification, for a break, which is a modification, for some sort of agreement, some sort of reduction, which is a modification, to knock something off the bill, which is a modification, and they want you to apply, which is what you're doing. You are applying to the debt collector to say, help me out because I agree you're my creditor and you can do something for me and you can knock this down and you can get my payments down. And the important thing is not the three trial payments that you make. That's nothing. The most valuable element of them offering you that modification is to get you to sign, validate that account by your signature, agree that they have an interest and they're your creditor and that they need to do something to help you. And many times, you know what? They'll just take that modification agreement. They're going to lose the paperwork about 8 or 9 times. And then they're going to go ahead and then they're not going to give you the modification. And you know what's going to happen when you go and you learn the information and I will teach you? They're going to say, well, that's fine and cool, but you already applied to us. So you re-aged this account, although the statute of limitations had already told. And although you might have found out now that we're not your creditor, you had applied to us for services. You applied to us for a workout, for a modification, okay? So this is a trick, okay? All right, this is a trick, and I'm telling you right now, it's a trick. Do I tell people not to do it? If you don't have all the information and you can't get a hold of a good attorney to litigate your claims, then and you have to do a modification, okay, we have a way to deal with it after you've done so. But understand that if you have a bad loan, modifying that bad loan doesn't change the condition of the bad loan. Okay,
exactly.
Especially if it was a party that wasn't authorized to modify the loan anyway. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That is fraudulent. That is a deceptive practice. That is a violation of the consumer protection laws and more than likely your state consumer protection laws. So, yes, you still can recover if you do so. So this is the second thing that you said I want to cover. They'll also say you can do a deed in lieu. Okay? Okay, a deed in lieu, meaning that you can sign over your mortgage to them.
Right.
Again,
right.
Again, they need your signature. They need you to agree that they are who they say they are, not who you know they are. And or you can do a short sale, meaning that you're going to be the fool, and I'm not talking about you and I'm not calling you a fool, but you're going to be the fool to go find them a buyer, okay, to pay the debt collector for your property.
Right.
Do you understand?
Which I understand.
Is
she's,
okay.
She's underwater. She's underwater from doing a refinance, which is how
doesn't
she got
matter.
Hooked up with me. Okay.
Yeah. Brother, let me tell you something. She's not underwater. I mean, you may have the perception that she's underwater, but let me tell you this fact. Nobody
uh-huh.
is underwater. When this mortgage industry was booming, they inflated the appraisal amount of these properties so the banks can get more money. The current value of your property now is what it has always been worth.
Right.
It's just it had to go down to its actual value. They only inflated it because they were giving anybody who could fog a mirror a loan. So if your property was worth $200,000, they were saying that it was worth $350,000. That's why you have a lot of appraisers that are in jail, okay,
mm-hmm.
or have been sued for inflating appraisals. So your mother is not underwater. Do not fall for that trick. Okay? Her property is worth now what it was worth when she got the loan. This is what you need to do. You need to follow your consumer protection laws. You need an audit of your documents. You need to look at your mother's original documentation. You need to look
mm-hmm.
at the documentation that exists in the county recorder. You need to ask qualified questions to this debt collector, because I'm presuming that they are. Okay? And then you need
mm-hmm.
to take action against them. What state are you in?
In Maryland. In Maryland.
And there's a judicial state, right? Maryland has a process that's not necessarily judicial, but not necessarily non-judicial. You kind of go through a protocol, correct?
Brother, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm
brother,
not,
you need to email
not,
me. Just email me offline, and then I can step you through what you need to do to save your mother's property. One of the things you might consider doing is to be attached to a legal title of that property so you can help defend your mother's property after 20-something years of a 30-year mortgage. I'm sure
yeah.
you can sue and make them go away because your mother has way more interest than any Johnny-come-late debt collector who wants to scoop up your mother's 20-something years of hard work on the
yep.
failure for her to pay the increased appraised value that the bank never was supposed to get anyway. Do you understand what I'm saying? Your mother, that property
yes,
should have been paid probably 10 years ago, okay, based
exactly.
on the inflated appraised value. So we're not going to let that happen. That is something that really fires me up is the elderly and them taking advantage of the elderly that's been out there taking care of our generation and got through the point to where they deserve to have their houses free and clear and be debt-free and retire and relax and enjoy the fruits of their labor. But we have these Johnny-come-late debt collectors saying that she owes $20,000 and you want to take away the $200,000 she's paid over the course of 20-something years. That's not going to happen. Email me, and I'll tell you what to do, brother. All right?
All right. I appreciate it, bro. Thank you very much.
Thank you, brother. Peace. Give blessings to your mom, man.
Thank you.
All right. I get fired up about the elderly. We have to protect our elders. We have 26 minutes left in the live stream, 26 minutes left I'm going to try to get to all these questions. I will not be going over if I don't have to. We're going to go to, let's see, 904-804-8999, 904-8999, your high-frequency radio. Do you have a question?
Hey, Sharif, I wanted to get that that email.
The Lawmaster, THEMASTER, 44 at yahoo.com.
Okay, The Lawmaster?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, brother. Peace. All right, we're going to take a minute break. Let me replenish some of my fluids. I'm getting a little dry. We're going to take 1 minute break, and we'll be right back.
Yeah. It's Rick Ross. It's that L.A. Reed flow right here. Now you're whining. Hold up. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I buy blow, so I supply bricks. Motherfuckers looking at me sideways, but can't tell that I'm getting money by ways. Lot of leather wood and it's deep vibrate. Chatting with a bitch like your boy on my space. But she right here in my face. Take her to a fly place with a fly fireplace. No marshmallows, we had to draw burn. I done seen the world, girl, it's your turn. I told you lies all my life, but you pulled me down, wrong or right. So it's only right she get that Porsche truck. All black, black rims, call her Porsche. Let your weed blow in the wind, cause believe every D-boy need a friend.
And can we get away and enjoy?
Let's get ready to rumble!
Peace, I'm back. Y'all can tell I'm a boxing fan. I like to get riled up. Let's go back to the call lines. I got my saliva back in order. Wasn't our Dr. Delbert Blair wonderful yesterday? Great individual, man. I mean, this brother, 70-something years old. And I just want to share with y'all, I've spoken with him often. He needs some assistance on a matter, and I'm going to help him with it. And I spoke to him the other day, and he had me laughing because you wouldn't be able to tell he's 70-something years old, okay? 70-something years old, all right? And I spoke with him the other day. I said, how you doing, Dr. Blair? And he says, oh, Brother Sharif, I'm doing fine. I was out in the snow. He lives in Chicago. We're getting 10 inches, this amount of inches of snow. I said, 10 inches? I said, geez. He said, yeah, I went out to shovel some snow. And this is what I'm talking about, our elders, okay, taking care of the mothers and fathers of the universe, our elders that gives us direction, that has the knowledge of history, that can teach us how to take care of our minds, our bodies, our spirits. And he's out there shoveling his own snow. Where are the people? Where is the communities? This man shouldn't be shoveling anything. He should just be shoveling us his knowledge, trying to do a transfusion of his knowledge into our brains. But he told me, he says, Brother Sharif, he says, the snow was so deep, I went out there and I had so many layers on. I had on 4 pair of pants, and I had on 5 or 6 shirts, and I had on the boots, and he said, I was bundled up. And he said, I went out there, and he says, I'm old now. He says, and I fell. And I said, oh, man, Dr. Blair, were you okay? He said, man, I fell. And I realized how it feels to be insulated because I had on so many clothes, I hadn't realized that I fell. And I just started making angels in the snow. And I was just cracking up laughing. The sense of humor, man, that Dr. Blair has, being 70-something years old, and he talks with the same intensity and speed as I do, and 70-something years old is a testament as to how he takes care of himself, his body, and all of you should be supporting him and getting some of his products because I need that man's speed and agility and physical being.
So I just wanted to share that story with you. He's a great individual. He will be back on tomorrow, I believe, Yousef said, to do a part two of that show that was interrupted for some technical reasons. All right, let's go back to the lines. Let's see where I picked up. Let's go to 787. 787-0590, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Peace, brother.
Peace, brother. What's going on?
Bien, usted. ¿Cómo está la gente?
¿Cómo está? Mucho trabajo, caí. Bye, papi. ¿Qué tú quieres?
Great to hear from you. Excellent class, brother. Excellent class.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, man. I'm still waiting for your phone call, man.
You know what? I'm going to put you right down here. I'm sorry, man. I wrote your number on my pad, and then I don't know what I did with that pad. So I'm going to write you down right here. I'm going to write you down right here, and we're going to try to get over to Puerto Rico to do some buen trabajo, papi chulo.
Espera, Borique, la isla del amor.
Yes, sir. Está bien. So what's going on out there? Everything good? Everything good out there?
Everything is good, man. Thank you.
Good, man. I will call you today, okay? And email me, if you would, at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com to remind me. Because as you know, I attend to the people, and the people is huge. So sometimes I get distracted, but email me.
Does it to be on this number by text?
I'm gonna call you. I'm not going to text you, but I will text you. I will text you as soon as I get off the show, so you'll have my number, and then you can call me whenever you like because I get busy. I'm going to get 20, 30 calls after the show, or have to send the 20, 30 emails. Okay, so I'll talk to you today, and we'll get into it.
I had a question for you.
Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Okay.
Okay. How is somebody, is someone, guided the check, any creditor, IRS, how do you be able to eliminate that?
Garnishment, depending on who it is. Now, if you own student loans, I mean, the IRS and the government are partners. I don't know if y'all realize that, but they kind of work hand in hand. So they're going to take your tax return or they're going to take your check. And if you're dealing in that public arena, and they know everything that you do utilizing their Social Security number. It is not yours. It is theirs. So if you're using their number, you are presumed to be engaged in an activity that they can tax, okay? So if you're being garnished from a debt collector, an unsecured debt of some sort, then you can deal with that the same way I answered the other caller. If you wasn't served properly, you can go back to that court and say, hey, you know, this is erroneous, I wasn't served. Or if it's an unsecured debt, in many cases, you can bankrupt them through a Chapter 7 or 13, depending on your situation. You need to seek competent counsel, a bankruptcy attorney, or a bankruptcy preparer that can assess your situation and see which option would be best for you.
So you call
okay.
My brother.
All right, brother. I'll call you later, man. Promise. Love you, man. Thanks for calling from Puerto Rico, brother.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. All right. Let's go to 267-9318. 267-9318. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question? 9318.
Hello? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, sister. I had to click back on you.
Okay.
I was rolling. How are you? State your name and what city you call. What state you're calling from?
Zoe. Philadelphia.
All right. Philadelphia. All right.
Okay. I wanted to ask you was my daughter signed the contract to move into an apartment, but she didn't read it, and when she got home, she read it. She realized that she didn't want to be in the contract. What can she do about it?
How long between her reading the contract and executing the contract, what was the length of time?
7 days.
7 days. So she signed a lease, correct?
Yeah, Yes.
Okay. You're not going to be able to get out of that. Lease agreements are, lease agreements are, you know, once you execute those contracts, they're binding. There's no cooling off period to my knowledge. I can just, you know, direct you to your state laws to find out in Philadelphia whether there is a cooling off period, and it's called a cooling off period for leases. Once you sign a lease and they give you the keys, you're pretty much locked in, and if you don't act within the content of that lease, then they can sue you for the 2 years or the duration of that lease regardless. And I've had people do that. It happens. And I know you're going to teach her a lesson for not reading, okay, from this point on, but that's not going to help you. The best thing to do is, to, you know, when we do these things is to just try to go back and not be combative, not be confrontational and say, listen, my daughter executed this contract. I do know that it is a viable contract, and I do know you've done nothing wrong. But I'm just asking, possibly, since she hasn't taken possession of the property, something else came up that would cause her not to be able to perform within that contract. And I'm asking that you make a decision ethically, morally, to let us out of that if you possibly can. Well, you can keep our deposit maybe, okay? You can keep the application fee, but just she's not going to be able to perform for the next 2 years as written in that contract. And whether it's now or 2 months from now, you and I are going to be facing this dilemma. Will you let her out? I know it's a very nice property. You can probably lease it to someone else. I know you can get out of it, but it makes no sense of you and I going through the legal requirement, you spending money to evict her when we all know it's going to happen anyway. So I just, you know, you use peace in your spirit as a mother, which I can tell you have, and sit down and talk with them and try to come to an agreement. Now, people are not unreasonable. You know, some people will say, okay, you know, I understand. This is what we'll do. We'll keep your security deposit, and we'll let you out, as opposed to her getting a judgment on her credit for 2 years, you know, and incur all those fees and deal with that. Just go down and sit with them. And, Mother, I think you have the spirit and the ability to turn that situation around. And I think God will help you find the words, okay, to levy upon them to know that you're coming to them sincerely and you're not trying to avoid that obligation.
All right. Okay. She never got the keys, but I like the way that you put it. She never seen an apartment.
And she probably never got the keys. She might have paid her first month in the first month deposit, and then she was due to get the keys, or she might have paid a deposit and the keys haven't come yet. You know, regardless of whether she had the keys or not, she's held up that apartment and they've been unable to rent it. So you sort of damaged them in a way that, you know, they reserved it for you. Even though you didn't take possession, they could have rented it. So I think if you go back to them at that stage and she hasn't taken possession, Mother, I think you can turn that around. It might cost her a little bit, but it wouldn't cost her as much in the long run.
Yeah, because she paid for just for the application. But I understand what you're saying. Okay, she didn't put any money on towards the rent, but I understand what you're saying, and I like that. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mother, and peace and blessings to you. And let us know how it turned out.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's go to 401-8187. 401-8187. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Well, how you doing, Brother Reese?
I'm doing great, brother. How are you?
I'm all right. Just quick question. I've been cutting in and out because I'm working. But you mentioned something about your 8-hour seminar that you had.
Yes.
In that seminar, were you talking about you just told the other caller how you can show her how to make money with cleaning up a credit report, or at least cleaning it up. Is that in that seminar?
Brother, no, it was a – let me differentiate. It's a webinar, not a seminar, so it's all audio.
I mean, webinar,
Okay, but and I just wanted to make sure you knew that because people will say, "Oh, it's a seminar. Is it visual?" No, it's not visual. Doing webinars. But yeah, in that webinar, brother, I went so far in that I think I touched on just about everything I can touch on, but I don't think it was specifically geared towards the FCRA and cleaning up your credit and making money. Those webinars were reserved to part two that just went on this past weekend and the one before that, that was, I believe, in December. And what I did was I took it in stages. I showed you how to start off the first part of disputing information and how to do it, and that there is a method to doing it. Okay, don't think you would just go on there and do it and it's going to turn out right. So I took him to that stage, and then the second stage, we went into what you do when you've completed the first stage. I'll have a third part, which will be the final part, which will deal with how to get into, you know, possibly taking litigation action against the debt collector and, you know, cashing in on them funds. And many times, I'll be honest, I've had four of the students call me because I'm able to demonstrate how you can send certain letters to the debt collector and not even go to court, and they're going to send you your money because they know they're pretty much liable for it and they don't want to incur the legal expenses by you suing. So a lot of times they'll just send you the check, you know, if you sit down and you write a proper letter and you engage them proper. So I think you need to get the first two webinars, and then next month attend the third one, and I think you'll have most of what you need to get into cleaning your credit. Along with James Hunter will be here next week, and he will be able to add some things that even I didn't know, a couple of things that I didn't know, ways that will expedite, you know, the cleaning up of your credit. All right, brother? So you need the first two webinars and the third one next month. I wouldn't advise that you get the third webinar, the second webinar, because you need the first, because I do things in stages. I don't kind of throw everything at you and expect you to catch it all. Okay?
Yeah. How do you get access to those webinars?
You just email me, thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. Just email me and let me know which webinars you're interested in. There is a donation for the webinars. Let me let y'all know that. Everybody donated to come to the webinars because, you know, I spent a lot of time doing that. So just want to let you know that. But, yeah, just email me, brother, and tell me what topic, you know, you want to cover. And I have a webinar out there for that topic, FDCPA and FCRA. Okay? After
at Gmail,
I've done
right?
the FCRA at Yahoo. I'm sorry, brother. Yahoo.
At Yahoo. Okay. Yep.
After I finish on the FCRA, we're going to go to the TCPA, which is another big money consumer protection law that we can collect on, and we're going to go into that, which is the Telephone Communication Protection Act. All right?
Okay.
All right, brother. Peace. Thank you for calling in. Thanks for taking an interest, man, in your own situation. All right, brother? Peace to you.
Not a problem.
Get back to work, man. Make that money.
Yeah.
All right, brother. All right, we got two more callers. I got 8 minutes left in the live stream. Let's go to 267-3782, 267-3782. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes. Hi, brother. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, mother and sister. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great.
What's plaguing you today?
You had spoken in the past in reference to Chase when they took over certain things from Wachovia. But you said they...
Not Wachovia,
right.
WAMU, Washington Mutual.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for correcting me. Yes, I took over Washington Mutual. However,
okay.
In my situation, I've been in my house, I think it's 27 years I've had the property, and so therefore over the 27 years it's probably changed hands seven times, if not more, or somewhere in that
sure.
figure. Along
sure.
with the records, it says something about Development Authority. That's what's
mm-hmm.
posted in the record. It never showed where other alleged lenders or transferees in any of the records in City Hall. But I was just basically trying to remember what you said about Chase and Washington
sure.
Mutual.
Yeah, and that's a good question. Sure. Washington Mutual was a national banking association who participate in lending for consumers, okay? In most cases, Washington Mutual, like Bank of America, like IndyMac Bank, and other banks participated in the securitization of mortgages.
Before you
finish,
I'm about to die, and so if I lose you, just keep talking So
I will, and
I
will answer your question, and I will go in depth. Yes, Mother. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
so Washington Mutual had, you know, filled out mortgage paperwork with you, and it was presumed that Washington Mutual was making a loan to you out of their own funds. But what they were doing was they had these REMICs, real estate. They had these REMICs out there, investors that had certain pools and funds set up to purchase the interest in your mortgages. Okay, notice I said interest. They didn't purchase mortgages. Okay? Most of these investors were state, county, pension funds, okay, retirement funds, private equity trust. Everybody invested in them because our country, by and large, makes most of their money on real property, on the land, okay? Most of your commodities come out the land, oil, resource, paper, trees, animals, okay? The land is where the country survives, and that's where commerce is really focused on the benefits of land and land purchases. So Washington Mutual, like others, did the paperwork with you. You were under the impression that they were making a loan to you. But what they were doing is they had a REMIC set up, real estate mortgage investment conduit, and really they had this fund set up, and when they did the loan, they had the REMIC, okay, pay the proceeds of the loan. So really the banks never lent any money. They used someone else's money. So Washington Mutual did that. Okay, and when Washington Mutual did that, they sold your loan into the secondary market. Okay, and when they sold the loan into your secondary market, that loan became part and parcel of that REMIC. Right now, Washington Mutual had a company, and let me get the exact name. I believe it's WMI. Washington Mutual Investments, and Washington Mutual Investments was the pass-through vehicle, was the company that they sold those loans to, and that company sold the loans into the secondary market to the investors, all right? I'm giving y'all this brief overview on securitization without going all the way in and confuse you, because you don't need to be confused other than who was named on the documentation as your lender was not the lender, and you need to get proof that Washington Mutual Bank, not Washington Mutual Investments, lent you money. So the loan was sold from Washington Mutual to Washington Mutual Investments. Washington Mutual Investment was a subsidiary but a separate company than Washington Mutual Bank, who is listed on your mortgage documents. Okay? When Washington Mutual collapsed, like all the other fraudulent banks who sold their loans into securitization, and the whistle got blown on this whole fiasco, okay, Washington Mutual Bank was taken over by the FDIC. The FDIC takes over a bank when they go into financial difficulties or trouble. Okay? So the FDIC took over Washington Mutual, and they sold Washington Mutual, and the assets, listen to me closely, the assets that were remaining with Washington Mutual Bank. Notice I didn't mention Washington Mutual Investments. Washington Mutual Investments was not a part of Washington Mutual Bank, who is listed on your mortgage. Okay? So there, in other words, there was a sale of your alleged loan that you didn't know of, which is a breach of your mortgage, deed of trust, security deed, or whatever instrument they use for your particular state. So there was a sale that was unbeknowing to you. That's the first issue. So it was sold from Washington Mutual to Washington Mutual Investments. When Washington Mutual Bank closed down, they sold it to, we have 90 seconds left in the live stream, so if you want to continue to call, you have to call in now or you will not be able to get in within the next minute.
If you're listening on the internet, you'll be quite fine. Just continue to listen. Okay, so Washington Mutual went under. FDIC took over. They sold Washington Mutual Bank to Chase. That is called a purchase and assumption agreement, which memorializes that purchase. Okay? The purchase and assumption agreement is between the FDIC, and it's an agreement that says that, okay, we're the FDIC. We took off of Washington Mutual Bank. We're selling to Chase, the bank. We might be selling the parking lot. We might be selling the buildings. We might be selling the vaults. We might be selling the deposit of particular people who had money in those banks. Okay? But what they did not sell was Washington Mutual Investments, who had took your loan and sold it into the secondary market. So what Chase did, along with the FDIC and all the other crooked public officials up there, is Chase came in and said, although all your loans were already sold, okay, all of your loans were sold prior to Chase purchasing certain, and listen to my words, certain assets of Washington Mutual Bank. They did not buy or purchase Washington Mutual Investments, who held your mortgages for a short time prior to selling it to the investors via Wall Street into a stock via REMIC. Chase came in and said, sent you a letter and say, hey, we bought, and everybody's assuming, we bought Washington Mutual Bank, so send all your payments to us. When they knew that, Washington Mutual had already sold all of those mortgages into the secondary market. Evidence of that is when you get a letter that says your new lender is Washington Mutual CWABS 123456-2005-7. You will realize that the numbers that represents that REMIC is usually either on or close to the time you executed your mortgage. So they sold it into a trust. Let's say you did a loan January 2005. They will sell it into a REMIC that's usually within 90 days to 6 months that was formed within that time. So you will almost always, not unless you did a mortgage in December of 2012, they might have put it in a REMIC that's like January or February 2013. But usually it's going to be within 3 months, 3 to 6 months of the time you did the mortgage. So when you see that information and that REMIC information on your documentation, you know that several things has happened. One is that Chase couldn't have owned the loans if it was sold same year you executed your mortgage. So if you did your loan in 2005, okay, and Chase took over WaMu in 2009, then how can Chase buy anything when in 2005 WaMu had already sold it to Washington Mutual Investments, and Washington Mutual Investments had already sold it into the REMIC, which is right there in front of you. When I say read your documentation, you will see that the trust that purports to own your mortgage is a 2005-something trust. So if the trust owned it in 2005-7, and Washington Mutual didn't go under until 2008 or 2009, then how can Chase had bought anything that resembles a mortgage loan? So within this purchase and assumption agreement, there is no evidence anywhere that Chase bought any loans. That means in order for Chase to say that they own your loan, you have to say, okay, well, show me some evidence, documentary evidence or admissible evidence, that shows that when you bought Chase Bank that you didn't buy anything other than the building or the deposit or the parking lot or the buildings. Show me something that evidences you purchased my loan when you purchased Washington Mutual. And they are unable completely to provide that documentation. Okay? So just like IndyMac and One West, for those of you that have them, same situation. When IndyMac closed, IndyMac already had an investment company that sold those mortgages into the secondary market. That means when One West
purchase IndyMac, they only purchase certain assets, certain things, not loans, not mortgage loans. Another thing you need to look out for is these assignments, because pursuant to the pooling and service agreement, which you will know otherwise as a PSA is a trust document between the REMIC, okay, and the investors. It determines what percentages they get. It depends on what certificates you buy. You can buy A certificates, B certificates, C certificates. You can put in $1,000. You can put in $20,000. You can put in $100,000. So based on the amount of certificates you buy and what tier level you buy determines how much of the interest of the payments that you make on your mortgage. Okay? So I won't go too much further than that, but within the pooling and service agreement, which is the agreement between the investors and the REMIC, okay, the investors and the REMIC, okay, that agreement says that these loans, when they were done, that means the investor said when you are using our money, because the investors funded your mortgage, allegedly, okay, okay, let's just say they did fund it. Okay, I'm not going to say allegedly. They did fund it. Okay? Everybody put in a pool of money, and they bought certain mortgages. You can buy A-tier level mortgages, B-tier. You know, you bought based on the consumer's purchase ability. If you had a 700 credit score, you was in a certain category. You can buy 600 credit scores, okay? And that determines on who's going to pay. 700 credit score is going to pay better than a 600 credit score, okay? So it depends on the risk and how much money you want to invest. So what happens was when they sold those loans, those assignments, those loans had to be assigned, meaning that ownership had to be within the REMIC within 90 days. Okay? No later than 90 days. That is called the cutoff date, okay, for us to receive the documentation, meaning that the assignments that you guys see now that is 4 and 5 years later are void. So that means the REMIC did not get anything, did not gain an interest in your loan, did not get anything. What did they get? They got screwed by the banks, okay, which is why you have a lot of these REMICs trying to sue different private equity funds, different retirement funds are suing. It's just a lot of people lost retirement. It affected everybody. It affected public officials who were invested, had their retirement invested in these mortgage vehicles. Okay? Everybody got screwed. Okay? So, but these assignments that you're seeing now are assignments that have no probate of value because they wasn't done in compliance with the pooling and service agreement, which is governed by New York trust law. Okay? New York, Capitol Wall Street, okay, is where Wall Street comes up with all these kooky, freaky programs that makes the country money. And most of them are like casinos in Nevada. Okay? So, these assignments that you see, and you should be able to identify them, are years past the allowed time for them to assign your loan to that REMIC. That means, let me just say this without going too much into it, because I think I've given you enough to understand that Washington Mutual, that Chase didn't take over anything belonging to Washington Mutual but their buildings. They didn't take your loan. And when you look at those assignments, that will be the only evidence you need to see that, well, I know that if this REMIC says 2005-7 and that trust was formed, let's say January 2005, then no later than April, let's say, 2005, that assignment should have been in the county recorder assigning that loan to that trust, but they never were. What they did was the banks turned around and instead of, they used the investor's money to make the purchases, meaning that they didn't come out of their pocket, meaning that your paperwork is defective. That means they was not the lender as alleged in your paperwork. Okay, that is called a straw purchase. You can't say that I lent you money when somebody else lent it. So what happens is, I'm trying to keep this as simple as possible. What happens is the investors paid for your loan, didn't get the proper documentation and ownership of that loan, and the banks instead just paid them the interest to keep the trust going. Okay, they just paid the interest without having to pay the money. Okay, that's all I'll say. Everybody got screwed. The investors got screwed. You're getting screwed. And the banks, in some respects, in most regards, are getting away with it. So that's the best that I can offer you, keeping it simple. But what I'm trying to tell you simply is that the questions you want to ask is, I need you to prove through the money trail, through documentation, that first of all, Washington Mutual made this loan. I need you to look at your documentation and see if you have any evidence of it being sold into the secondary market by Washington Mutual Investments. And then I need you to look at assignment and determine whether it's in compliance with New York trust law and the pooling and service agreement. And you can obtain that information a lot of times by doing some form of a securitization audit, and you should do that anyway. Or sometimes you don't have to do that because the evidence exists right there in the assignment, where it tells you that it's owned by or certificate holders of the blah, 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 blah. That indication will tell you that it has been securitized, and all you need to do simply without getting the securitization audit is, if you Google that REMIC, you will find the pooling and service agreement. In that pooling and service agreement, it will tell you who the depositor is, who the master servicer is. It'll tell you all the parties that are supposed to be involved. But the important thing it will tell you and it will demonstrate is that even the REMIC doesn't own your loan, because they did not receive the proper documentation in proper form, and they did not receive it timely. Therefore, the bank doesn't have an interest in your property, because I just told you they never made the loan, okay? And what the bank is doing, being that they know they screwed the REMIC, is that they're coming back and they're taking a house from you, which essentially means they didn't pay for the loan. Now they're coming trying to take your house, so they're trying to get paid twice. Yes, that's our banking industry in this country, and no bankers are in jail, and they're walking around living high on the hog, and our government is just making agreements with them, settlements with them, to get a part of the stolen money, okay, and not give you any of it. Can't be any more clearer than that. Hopefully everybody understands that. Sister, I hope that answers your question. You can Google a lot of that information, and it will support what I'm telling you. Hopefully I made it plain enough. I don't like to be too intricate, because I don't want to lose you, because that information is very deep. You just need to understand Washington Mutual more than likely did not make that loan, and the trust never received that loan properly. Therefore, you don't owe either party, okay? Otherwise, your debt is unsecured, and it's without a creditor due to fraud, not on your part, but on the national banking industry's part. All right, we're going to go to the next question here. Let's go to 615-9983. 615-9983, do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Yeah, I got a question and a comment. My comment first. I definitely appreciate what you've been doing for the network, man. I heard you call on last week. Well, the people, you were venting in regards to the people asking you to do stuff for free. Man, tell them folks to go on somewhere with that. You doing stuff for free, man? You doing it for free,
brother,
man?
Brother, I'm telling you.
Get up on it.
Thank you. Appreciate you, brother.
Don't let them kill your spirit, man. They try to put a different spell on you, man. You're doing what you're supposed to do. I like what you're doing, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Question for you. I am trying to get a case reopened based on some newfound evidence regarding foreclosure, on alleged foreclosure. And I've heard you speak in regards to MERS not being in existence anymore. How do you go about getting that information as far as showing the court that at the time of this particular transfer that they're governing everything off of, MERS was not even in existence to do this transfer?
Sure, and that's a good question, and I'll go into that. And that's another deep question that most of us need to understand. First of all, it's absolutely correct. MERS has changed names, man. Since MERS has become MERS was thrown out there as a distraction. MERS was created by the banks. MERS is not a company that just came up and decided to do electronic registration for your mortgages because it benefits us. MERS was thrown in there to kill the records of the county recorders. And as you know, the county recorders historically are the information holders from back when there wasn't computers. You understand? The county in any state is the most important office in that state because it holds and retains records of land ownership from back in slavery times. Okay?
Correct.
That's how important the county is. So what happens when the banks started involving themselves in these Wall Street gimmicks and securitization, they needed to create their own county recorder because they were doing all these illegal things with the mortgages. So they didn't want to abide by state law. They wanted to create this mortgage registration system because of two reasons, in my beliefs and from what I've seen. And many others will agree. One, they wanted to create, they didn't want to pay all those fees to the state. Why? They were stealing from every citizen of that state, and they just didn't even want to pay the state their fees, okay? But they felt that they were giving the state the taxes. Like, look, we're creating all these illegal mortgages. You're getting the taxes and the property tax. Like, shut up. You know what I mean? So that's what the banks were saying. Secondly, we can't be recording every maneuver that we do because we're assigning these things like weekly or monthly, and I'm exaggerating to some extent. Okay, so we don't want to let you know what we're doing because we got the scam running, and we can't let you in on it, and we don't want to cut you in on it. All right? So they created MERS, and they decided to keep – and if you have MERS on your mortgage documentation, your security deeds, your deed of trust, more than likely that is a great indication that your loan was sold into the secondary market, more than likely, either through a private label trust or through the REMIC. Okay? Some of them you can find. Some of them you can't. Some of them will send you documentation that will give you an indication that it was. Some of them won't. You have to go look it up for yourself. Okay? That's what the securitization audits are for. So MERS was designed by the banks, and Bank of America, Chase, I believe, several of the big banks say, look, let's create our own electronic registration system. And they did so. So you have within your contract, it says MERS. Okay? And MERS plays more roles than every position on a basketball court, okay? They're considered as a nominee. They're considered as a lender. They act for, you know, the coach. They act for the CEO. I mean, they pretty much can jump all over the place like a king of spades, okay? So they can do just about what they want to do, but they really can't do nothing when you think in common sense terms. It makes no sense. But yet you'll have some judges that will justify and be like, oh, yeah, they can do that. Oh, yeah, they can do that. And you'll have 50 judges that say they can do it, and you'll have 10 judges that say, no, they can't. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But at any rate, throughout this whole catastrophe, the MERS had allowed the banking industry to steal a lot of properties because before this information really came to fruition and the courts started getting a hold of it, 3, 4, 5 years had already passed. And, you know, the courts always take the bank's word and be like, yeah, oh, they can do that. Yeah, they can do that. Yeah, we don't need to look into it. The bank said that's what it is. So a lot of homes has been stolen before we figured out the MERS BS. All right? So MERS, during that time, being that people started to catch on and they started getting sued, they changed their name like 3 or 4 times. You can find the name changes in the state of Delaware where they were incorporated, okay? If you look into the state of Delaware and you see MERS, it started off as MERS, and I believe throughout a couple of name changes, it is now called MERS Corp. Okay? It's not called MERS anymore. MERS is dead. MERS, the entity, is dead. So how can a dead entity be doing assignments of mortgages or notes? And let me explain what MERS is able to do and what they're not able to do. MERS only holds, if they hold anything, the mortgage. As you know, there's two parts to a mortgage transaction. There is a note, and then there's a mortgage. The mortgage operates as a lien for purposes of recording in the county recorder. Doesn't mean that it is a lien. It doesn't mean the lien was perfected. It just means it operates as notice to the public that there is a lien by that bank. They don't hold the note ever. They're not listed on the note. They're listed on your mortgage, your security agreement, or your deed of trust. They don't ever take payments on a note. You can't pay MERS for nothing about your payments. They don't own any interest in the note. As you know, the note is the most important element of that transaction because the note has the terms of repayment, who you should pay, what should happen if you don't pay, okay? And the mortgage is incident of the note. Okay? You cannot sell the mortgage and not the note. You can sell the note, the mortgage follows with it. But you can't sell the mortgage and the note follows with it. That means there can be a mortgage holder and there can be a note holder. The note holder is the big dog. He makes all the rules and the regulations. The mortgage holder just deals with the mortgage. That might be what you call a servicer, and they may get instructions from the lender, which is the note holder, to say, look, I'm going to cut my man a break. He don't have to pay this month. Do this and do that. That comes from the lender. In your mortgage contract, your deed of trust, your security deed, your mortgage, it will tell you in almost every provision that the lender can do this and do that and do that and do this. It will never say the servicer can, and it will only say that MERS can do certain things with permission expressly from the lender. That means the lender must tell MERS, hey, listen, go ahead and let me see. My man over there, Yusef, go ahead and transfer that mortgage over to Yusef and tell Yusef I said go and get your property because I'm tired of dealing with you. Okay? Okay? That's what can be done. I got to tell him that. I'm a note holder, though. And I can tell MERS, go on and sign that over to my man. Tell him to go down there and go ahead and foreclose on that property. I can do that because I'm the note owner. That means the payments go to me. The mortgage don't mean anything. Okay? The mortgage is just memorializes the transaction, has all the rules and regulations that governs you and him, okay? So what you find in these assignments is that, one, I just told you, MERS is out of business. MERS Corp is the new company. So that means all the actions of MERS should not be occurring, but there were already millions of these assignments already in the county recorder. Now, if they were done while MERS was in existence, then you know, then I guess they did it within their rules rightly. But legally, I don't think MERS could do anything. But let me tell you the issue that you find. MERS in itself is nothing because they can't do anything without permission from the lender. So let me give you an example, Brother Sri. You got a lot of lenders who went out of business. Let's give you an example, Washington Mutual. Now, brother, let me tell you something. Let's say someone you know, a friend of yours, passed away, right? If that man passes away, can you use a power of attorney for the next 5-10 years after he's dead?
No, sir.
Because when he died, his power died. Now, that man can leave you a will and testament and say, this is how I want my property divided or given out. I want my kids to have this. I want this and that. But that's about it. You can't be going, you know, the man died today, and then next year this time you still going and open up bank accounts in his name, and he dead just because he left you a power of attorney. The power dies with him other than your probate court who's going to divide up his assets. You understand that part, correct? That's just simple. If Washington Mutual goes out of business, they die, and Washington Mutual is the only one that can give instructions for MERS to do something, then how can MERS do an assignment 2-3 years after Washington Mutual died and they're just acting on their own without – and it says in your mortgage, if you read it, it says the lender can give written – it says written permission to MERS to do this, that, or the third. So we know that if Washington Mutual or Indy Mac or all these hundreds of other banks that went out of business, we know they're not giving permission to MERS to do anything, but MERS is still trying to act like they're living and they got permission to do something. Second of all, you will find that there's a lot of assignments out there that purport to assign the mortgage from MERS and the note. That is absolutely 200 million% defective, illegal, and erroneous. Because Merce never holds a note. They never take possession of a note. They never get paid on a note. They never see the note. They don't even know what a note looks like. So you have a lot of assignments out here, some of which you may have, that will be purport to assign the note and the mortgage. You should totally, unequivocally, and overwhelmingly beat the snot out of them with that piece of paper and sue them and get money for years for every time. Because if Merce, if you have an assignment in the record that has that type of language in it, that your mortgage and note was assigned, can they ever correct that? Can they ever make that right? No. So you have an unenforceable mortgage because they were stupid enough to put that document out there. And when you come to court, you don't get angry. You says, now, Judge, the document that they rely upon for standing before the court here today and exhibited in my complaint as Exhibit A demonstrates that this party that is here today, I don't care if it's been transferred five times, I don't care if it's been transferred one time, demonstrates that Merce allegedly, who is not in business anymore, mind you, to assign the note and the mortgage to this debt collector, appearing and acting and masquerading themselves as a creditor. Now, Judge, if you go to Merce's website and you look under the terms and conditions, meaning their rules, not ours, Merce will tell you under no uncertain terms that they never acquire possession of any note. They are not named on the note. Okay, they are not party to the note. The lender controls the note. The lender has the controlling interest in the note. So before we get to anything else, I'm moving to court for immediate dismissal with prejudice, because that is not something that is amendable. They cannot do a corrective assignment, because if they never had the note, why would they imply that they did? You can't assign something that you don't have. The second thing, Judge, is that the assignment was done by Merce when the lender was out of business. And my mortgage documentation, meaning that my part of the contract that I executed, demonstrates that only the lender can give express written permission to Merce to do anything. They can't move on their own volition. So, Judge, I want you to determine how this particular entity is coming in here claiming that they own my mortgage, they have an interest in my mortgage, I need to pay them, or even further, that they are able to take my property utilizing this one particular document, which is the only document they can rely upon. That is the only document you're going to have to focus on, people, when you're dealing with these mortgages. Is it either you got a good assignment or you don't?
No. Yeah, that's what they're using. Yep.
You understand? Let me tell you the third part. Judge, I'm going to go further. I'm looking at the assignment, and it appears to say that the loan was assigned to a sold into the secondary market. And within my documentation, my mortgage agreement, it says that any sales or partial sales of the note, the lender must notify me. He has to let me know what's going on. He has to let me know if he changes hands in any way. Second thing it says, Judge, is that if the loan is ever paid to the lender, that they will file a satisfaction. It didn't say who paid it. It said if they are ever paid, that they will file a satisfaction. It didn't say if the borrower, read it, for those of you in deed of trust states, read it. It says if the loan is paid to the lender, a satisfaction will be filed. I can pay your mortgage off. The only thing the bank has to do is I got paid. I got to file a satisfaction in the name of the borrower. So they didn't do that. That's a breach. They didn't let you know they sold the note into the RMIC. That's a breach. Well, let's go further, Judge. The assignment purportedly assigned all interest in the note, or let's say interest in the mortgage alone, and you'll have that. So if your assignment is just for the mortgage alone, it's still defective because the mortgage alone is worth nothing without the note. Where is the mentioning of the note? Where is the note, Judge? Who owns the note? How can Merce just assign the mortgage? Who has the note? Okay, I need the note holder because when I pay my mortgage, I'm supposed to get a satisfaction and I'm supposed to get that note back. Am I not? That note is your property. That note is your property. It's a check. When you write a check to a supermarket, Okay? Usually back in the day, she used to have to write a check. Now they keep it on microfiche. She used to write a check, and once they paid the check and it went through the banking system, they sent you back the canceled check. Did they not? You remember you used to get them in the mail? And then they had to where you can now do it electronically, and they keep it on microfiche, or they send you an email, electronic copy, because people would just throw it away. So when you pay a note, it's supposed to come back to you, that same note. And they make a copy of your check and send you back the canceled check. They sent you back the original check. Okay? So, Judge, this assignment purportedly was assigned to the REMIC 4 or 5 years after the REMIC. The REMIC never got interest in this mortgage note because the pooling and service agreement, the agreement that the investors made with the depositor, said that all the documentations must have been received prior to the cutoff date and the closing date. That was not done. And then there's another issue, Judge. The people that signed this, Vice President of MERS, are surrogate signers, also known as robo-signers. They had no authorization. There is no power of attorney. They never worked for MERS. Anybody could work for MERS. MERS, all you have to do is get a member number, and you can assign millions or trillions of dollars in mortgages just by being a member, like you being a member of Valley's Fitness Club. Okay? Judge, who has the power to assign trillions of dollars in mortgages and have a $10 an hour employee sign some documentation that they have no business signing? They're not authorized. Okay? Now, with all of those issues, the way I explained it, okay, and then you can add in, now, Judge, do not go into court telling the judge, now, Judge, I understand that somebody made a loan here. You can listen to all that nonsense and say, well, they never gave you anything, and, you know, it was your credit and all that. Yeah, I understand all that. I hear all that. But you ain't going to hear a judge agree with you, okay? And if somebody had a judge that agreed with them on that theory, call me. Call into my show next Tuesday at 11 o'clock, okay? Give me the order. I can pull it up. Give me the order that said the judge said they didn't do anything. You lent them something. You're a creditor. Just show me the order, and don't tell me about it because I'll embarrass you. Show me the order. Let me pull it up, and let me see that case number. But anyway, Judge, I know that I received a loan here from somebody, and I'm not denying that, okay? This works for me. I'm not denying that. This is the issue, Judge. What I'm telling you is that the party before you today is not the party that I owe. For example, Jeff loaned me money to buy this house. Jeff died and didn't let me know what was going on. If Jeff died or went out of business and he didn't come after me for the money, well, I'm the only other party to the contract who should benefit. Me, right? All right?
Right, yeah.
Maybe Jeff, right. In the event of his death, maybe Jeff had life insurance and said, look, if I die, just let everybody keep all that shit, okay? That stuff. Let everybody, I ain't worried about that. If I'm dead, I ain't going to do nothing with it. Just let it go. You follow what I mean? So Jeff loaned me the money. Jeff died or went out of business. And then here come Billy Bob later. And Billy Bob come out here after Jeff's death and says, hey, man, you got some money from Jeff. And I'm here to collect that. And I say, who are you? I'm one of the business people or friends or whatever of Jeff. I say, well, that's funny, man. Jeff died and went out of business. He never told me about you. There's no documentation supporting that agreement or relationship between you and Jeff. And you coming into court, and I'm going to say, Judge, now, I know I owe somebody. And far as I know, and if you want me to go further, Judge, I realize that Jeff really didn't loan me any money. Well, let's go based on what is here right now.
Right.
Let's go a little bit further than that, Judge. I got some documentation saying that Jeff really got the money from Guido. Okay? So, and that's illegal, Judge. Well, let me go further. You have to protect my right and the right of the contract, because there's several things wrong with this whole transaction. I can point them all out in the first law, which is the contract. That is the first law, the contract, okay? Mm-hmm. And you cannot make me pay, and you don't want to make me pay, Judge, Bobby or Billy Bob. You have to be careful ordering me to pay Billy Bob if I don't owe Billy Bob, Judge. Now, you don't want to make me give my house up, okay? My property,
my constitutionally protected right to have to be safe and secure in my possessions, which is my property. Surely, Judge, you wouldn't want to write an order that would have me turn over my real property and evict my family into the street with, first of all, this documentation, which is fraudulent, fabricated, and has no merit. And first of all, nowhere in that paperwork does it mention Billy Bob. Now, if I owe Jeff and you make me pay Billy Bob, then, Jeff, I got to hold you accountable for making me pay Billy Bob when the evidence that you have doesn't support the fact that I owe Billy Bob. You can understand that, right, Judge? And I understand that everything is commerce, is bonded, right? And you're bonded. I'm insured. I have car insurance. I have life insurance. It indemnifies me in case something happens, right? And as a judge and as a public official, you're bonded because, you know, doctors have to be insured. It's called malpractice. Attorneys have to be insured. It's called malpractice. So, Judge, I would ask you to consider whether Billy Bob would be liable or you would be liable to me if you made me pay Billy Bob and I really owe Jeff. Do you understand?
Do you understand? Yeah.
See, that's how you put it in realistic terms. Judge, if you make me pay Billy Bob when I done sold you, and the evidence is overwhelmingly in my favor that Billy Bob signed all these documents, he forged all that stuff while Jeff was dead, and he's coming over here trying to collect on Jeff's money when Jeff didn't have no, he had no intentions on collecting on it. And I can also prove, even go back further and say that Jeff never loaned me the money, and I've demonstrated this to you in court today, and you write an order that has me turn over my property that I've paid for 20 years, as the brother called for his mother, 22 years, and for the remaining $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 after I paid $300,000, you're going to have me turn my property over to Billy Bob when you can see that Billy Bob didn't loan me nothing? Then I'm going to hold you liable. You get what I'm saying, brother? That's all I can say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's it in a nutshell. That's all I can say. That's the best way to put it, to where you're not talking all that. I'm the creditor. Yeah, he ain't loaned me nothing. My signature was the credit. We got all that. Listen, you were the beneficiary of some real property. Somebody loaned you some money. And the judge can respect that. I'm like, judge, I'm not playing no games. Somebody loaned me some money. And you know what? If Billy Bob was the person that owed the money to, I owed the money to, me and Billy Bob would have to talk about a lot of stuff because I got a lot of violations and breaches of this contract that may rise to the level far beyond what Billy Bob says that I owe him. You dig?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Billy Bob, do you want to step up or you want to step out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yep.
You see what I mean? That's strategy, brother. That's real talk. That's something that a judge can wrap his mind around. That's the truth. That's no fluff. That's no game. That's no BS. That's just the facts.
Just the facts. Yes, sir.
Now, okay. And Billy Bob didn't make the judge write that order. Judge, you are telling me, you are determining, and based on what, I don't know, because I'm looking at the same evidence you're looking at, and you're the jurist. You know better than me that that documentation is not proper and it has no probative value. You know that. Now, if you make me pay Billy Bob after I've said that, after I've testified under oath and Billy Bob didn't, that's another thing. Y'all need to get these debt collectors on the witness stand and cross-examine their tales. You'll kill a lot of it. You need to take the stand and under oath and be like, I never borrowed any money from Billy Bob. I don't know who Billy Bob is. I'm looking at this documentation, and Billy Bob cannot have signed that documentation. I'm looking at my contract, and my contract says that Billy Bob can't do what he's doing. And I'm looking at that. I have evidence here that I got from the Securities and Exchange Commission or from over here from the county recorder, and I swear that that information is authenticated, and it says clearly that Billy Bob has no interest in this property. And I swear that I will be injured and damaged if this court makes me pay by giving Billy Bob my property or giving Billy Bob one payment. I don't owe him. And now let Billy Bob get on the stand and say and oppose that. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's how you kill a lot of it. Billy Bob is never going to take the stand. That attorney coming in there for Billy Bob is not going to take the stand and swear that you owe them money. They're not. They can say, well, you got a loan from Jess. And I'll be like, were you there in 2005? Okay, well, let's say I got a loan from Jeff. That's fine. I got a loan from Jeff. So what? What does that have to do with you? Okay, that's called a demur. A demur is, so what? Okay, I understand what you're saying. Like, you got a loan from Jeff. You didn't pay Jeff. And Jeff said that if you went in default, that he'd be able to do this and he'd be able to do that. And you know what? You can go in there and do a demur and be like, okay, so what? What does that mean? That don't mean I have to pay you. Okay? Right. You didn't name any facts that's determined that I got to pay you. So what? You're telling me about Jeff, and Jeff is not here, and you're not Jeff. You get it? No evidence. No standing, no capacity, no nothing. They should be ran out the court with you just taking a stand or providing a properly formed affidavit and let them come in there and rebut that affidavit. And they will not ever do it. There is not a mortgage out there that has been sliced and diced by way of securitization where a bank or debt collector, attorney or otherwise, can determine how much you owe to the penny. Not one. All right, brother, did I go deep enough?
Oh, yeah. Tell me, as far as getting that documentation or the authenticated document for saying that MERS stopped existing at a particular point, is that going through the Delaware, through the state?
If you email me, I will pull up that documentation and just Google it and put in MERS change name to MERS Corp, and you'll find that article out there that shows you the exact dates they changed their name in Delaware, and you can go to the Delaware Secretary of State and pull up that documentation that memorialized the multiple name changes that they went through.
Okay, now I'll shoot you the email too then. I appreciate it, man.
Okay, brother, appreciate you.
Keep doing what you're doing and let those haters stay haters. They just hate them.
Brother, let me say this. I don't think it's necessarily that they're haters. I just think it's pure laziness. I think we're always playing a victim role because we don't want to read. We don't want to take the time out to help ourselves. We want to always look up to somebody. We're always looking for leaders and gurus and role models. And, you know, it confuses me greatly how we're just so susceptible to be running after somebody. I was watching the news yesterday, and I was watching these politicians parading down the street, and I was watching people just running up to them and shaking their hands and asking for autographs. And I'm looking at the people, and I said to the person that was standing next to me, I said, what is it that they see person to where they hold them in such high regard? What has that politician done for them specifically other than maybe share some of the same ideologies and thoughts? Like, why are people lining up down the street, running down the street, asking for pictures and autographs of a man, a human?
Yeah.
Okay, a natural man, a man that bleeds and urinates and does wrong and does right and has his own belief system, same as you. Why do we look for God everywhere else but within ourselves and up in the sky? I don't get it. Like, I don't know how many years
running for office
that we have to. I don't know how many times do we have to go to the voting machine if you do that and continue to vote until you realize you ain't getting nothing out of voting. These people are liars. They're deceptors. They're going to do what they want to do. The country is way bigger than any office they can possibly have. That's all the way up to the president. How many times are we going to fall for that until we just realize, you know what, the God that I'm looking for, at least the resemblance of that God, first of all, is within me, okay? And I don't need to look to anybody else to help me except for the real, the ultimate the all-seeing, the all-creator, that's the only person I need to look up to. That's the only person I would follow down the street if they were here. But all these other defective humans and lying, sweet-talking, fast-talking, manipulating politicians and public officials, like, I don't get how many times we fall for that, brother. Don't get me wrong now, my eyes wasn't always open. Do you understand?
Right.
I did believe in that system before, so I'm not knocking. I'm not knocking people at all.
We all have drank the Kool-Aid and fell up under the spell. Some of us
indeed
have been able to get out of that spell. Some of us have been able to get out of that spell, but a lot of us haven't, so, and we just still spellbound right now.
Yeah, man, we still looking for the government already done told you now they can make you unemployed and make you out here scrambling and asking for food stamps. Do you understand? When do we get to the point where we, as our community, as a people, where we say, I'm never going to work for anybody ever again? I said that up 10 years ago. Okay, I'm a destined my own future. Okay, I'm responsible for my own future. I'm not going to depend on anybody applying for this company, this slave master, and then, you know, we do a resume to the other slave master, and we say, the other slave master thought I was a pretty good slave. You should hire me, too.
Wow. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's just crazy. It's just crazy
that's
to where as talented as we are as a people, all colors, as smart as we are, we should be able to tend to ourselves and create our own destiny and create, like, I've even at a young age when I worked for companies, I always sized myself up with the higher up who was there. And I'm like, what is the difference in him and me? How is he smarter than me? And he's not.
Yep.
And I figure out,
yep,
I learn what I need to learn, and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to open up my own company doing this. And I've always done that. I've done that since I was young. I'm like, man, listen, I can do what you're doing. Like, you're not that hot. You know what I'm saying? You're not that smart. You know? So, you know, as mothers and fathers of the universe, man, we're scientists, and we're able to mix it up, man. We're able to think outside the box, and we just take our intellectual property, and we offer it to these corporations for pennies on the dollar, and we fall into the mindset that we need them to promote our own minds, and we don't. Okay, starve those corporations to death. Open up your own small businesses. Offer your own services, even if it's on a small scale. Stop participating in the controversy. Stop being an individual. Stop being, you know, an employee. You know, just stop it, because they done showed us that the people that run this country don't give a damn about you. And they don't, and at any point when they feel like they want more money to pass down 100 generations, they're going to starve you, put you in the graves, poison your food, take all your jobs, send them overseas, and leave you like you never existed. It's ridiculous, brother. I'm sorry for that rant.
No, you're good. That needs to be said, man. It's bad out here. People don't want to get out of get from under the spell of the give-outs. They want to get handouts and be given this and given that because they're so trained to the propaganda on the TVs and the media, and it's just flooding their minds. They think it's real. They don't see the matrix out there. They don't understand that it's all fiction. They can't get past
all
that
fiction.
Color.
That's right.
Yeah, they can't get past. I appreciate it.
And the media just tell us how to think. You know, you can fall into that. Trust me, I used to be a media buff. I used to listen to everything. I'm like, oh, wow, you see what's happening over there? Oh, wow, you see what? And I said, you know what, that's a bunch of crock. Like, they're telling you how to think, telling you how to act, telling you what you should buy, telling you what you should eat, telling you when you should have a holiday, telling you what they create holidays. Like, last year there was like, this is a black – Not Black Friday. It was another holiday, like Internet Monday. And I was just like, wow.
Yeah.
I watch how they created another holiday for people to go spend trillions of dollars and call it Internet Monday, and people foolish to go out there and spend all their money because they think they're going to get a good deal, okay?
Yeah.
And it's Internet Monday. I'm like, I didn't have that holiday 10 years ago. Where did that come from? You understand? So they tell us when to celebrate. They tell us when to spend our money. You know, Valentine's Day is coming up, and some of us is going to go out there and spend $100 for $10 roses. because they told us to do so. We're going to spend $20 for $2 chocolates because they told us to do so. And when you look up the history of Valentine's Day, I don't think you would celebrate it, nor would you Easter, nor would you several of the mother holidays. Like, we just got to wake up, brother. And hopefully, you know, yourself, myself, and everybody were able to uplift our humanity, man, and realize that we should create our own holidays. You understand what I mean? We should create our own future. And hopefully, you know, we're getting that message out there. Brother, I thank you. Thank you for calling in. Hopefully the answer. I appreciate your input. And I'm going to go to this last caller so we can get off here. But thank you, brother.
Thank you. For sure.
All right. All right. Let's go to the last caller. 111111. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Peace.
Peace, peace.
Yeah, Islam. I was calling in regards to the certificate of non-response. I'm doing the administration process on the debt collector. Now, as far as filing the certificate of non-response, I'm kind of confused on that. Do you make that out yourself and give it to the notary in order the notary to stamp it and then send it out to the creditor or the debtor, or do the notary make one out and you take it?
Okay. Well, brother, let me say this. And I appreciate your question, and I understand what you're doing, and I hear it a lot, administrative process. There's a lot of those out there. Some of them are supported by certain laws in certain states, okay, which is a notarial process, okay? Some notaries are scared as hell of it because notaries don't want to be considered, let me say the magic word, practicing law, okay, which doesn't apply to the average individual. That just applies to that society. But a notarial process, to me, brother, is really not effective. And that is my opinion. Do you understand? What you should do, instead of going through that, okay, is instead of getting a notary to determine that somebody didn't answer, you should be going to the court with a complaint and a summons, okay? In other words, instead of you sending a correspondence to a debt collector and determining that they did not answer, and I don't know what information you're putting in this letter. You could be like, look, I'm coming to your house to take your keys, take your wife, take your boat, take your car, and if you don't respond, I'll be there tomorrow at 5 o'clock. I don't know what information you people put in these notary presentments or notary letters. I don't know if it's even and just hear me out, bro, because I don't know what you're putting in it. I'm just being broad with you. I'm trying to cover not just you but everybody else. But I don't know what information that you're putting in there or even if it's even supported by law. But this is what I do know works. So you send that letter out using notarial process, and the notary signs off that, yeah, he mailed this letter, and I don't know what it said, nor could the notary determine that what you said had any foundation in law. So you send this letter out and they don't respond, and you say you need to respond to the notary within 10 days. Now, I don't know if the 10 days is a requirement in law either. So they don't respond, and the notary writes you a certificate of non-response and says that whatever letter he sent, whatever language it contained, and whatever he said, I don't know if it was legal or not, they didn't respond. So you get the notary to say that, but then what are you going to do with it? And I'm asking you that question. I'm asking everybody, what are you going to do when they don't respond? Now you're going to take that and show up at the house, and the marshals are going to come with you and say, yeah, I did a notary process on them, and they didn't respond. I told them I was going to be there at 5 o'clock to take his boat or to take his house or to take the bank, or whatever. Brother, what I'm saying is this. You need to instead, in my opinion, send them some sort of correspondence that is supported by the consumer protection laws. For example, 15 U.S.C. 1692, 15 U.S.C. 1681, your consumer protection laws, okay, or a tort letter, okay, based on some breach or based on some harm that you experienced. Okay? And what you need to do is once you send them out a letter and they don't respond, you need to then go, if you have the ability and knowledge and wherewithal, you need to file a summons and a complaint, which means a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to serve them. And because they didn't respond to your letter that was supported by the consumer protection laws, you need to go to that court and you just say, court, I'm suing them because I sent them out this letter and they did not respond and or otherwise defend my allegations. I asked them for this particular information, which is supported by 15 U.S.C. 1692 or some provision thereof.
Right,
they
right.
did not respond, and I'm suing them for their breach or their failure to respond because the information that I asked was needed to prevent future harm, meaning that I asked them to give me this information about this loan so I can make a determination whether I should pay them. They didn't return that information to me. Therefore, I'm a month late on my payment, thereby experienced damage to my credit report because they reported me 30 days late. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you show the court, you file a summons and complaint, you sue them, and in the court, by the court rules, taking a proper procedure, you serve them with a summons and complaint, and you tell the court, I need you to hold them responsible for these damages. And then you serve them with a summons and complaint, and within 21 days, they don't respond to your summons and complaint. Now the clerk of that court, who has the power to issue a default, and then the judge of that particular case in that court, who has the power to issue you an order that can be cashed as a check in the form of a judgment, can say, you know what, he served you. He served you with a summons and complaint. The summons and complaint had the identical or even additional information that was supported in his correspondence to you, which you were required to answer, and you didn't answer. He brought it to the court. The court witnessed that he did everything procedurally correct. He served you. He sent you a copy of the summons. Even the clerk might have sent a copy of the summons. He did a Rule 55 default and judgment, and the court agreed that, look, you served them. You answered them. They didn't answer. They didn't defend it. So everything he says within the content of the complaint, within the body of the complaint, is held to be true. You had an opportunity to defend yourself. So I'm issuing an order in judgment against you for what he asked for, $100,000. Then you take that judgment and you do what everybody else do, and you get the U.S. Marshal to serve judgment if you know where they're located or if you know where their assets is or if you know where their building is, and now you get to take his boat and his motorcycle and his house or whatever it is or whatever, however much it takes to fulfill your judgment. Now, brother, I think that's a better way for you to go because I'm telling you right now, this notarial process stuff doesn't have any enforcement. You're going to do a notarial process, then you're going to do what? Who's going to enforce it? It has no enforcement. A notary can't give you a judgment and order. A notary can't do anything but witness that you did something, and that doesn't mean that what you did is proper. So why are you doing it? I don't know why people do it. I'm just asking you, and I'm not jumping down your throat. I'm just saying I don't know why y'all do that when y'all could do the same thing in court, small claims, state court, or federal court, and then have the court, meaning that you abide by the rules and you follow proper protocol and procedure, the court is the one that can write you a check in the form of an order or judgment. The notary can't. Am I answering your question?
The same process of going down the line when you go through it's about putting them in default. So you go through the process through the notary of a non-response.
Okay, brother, you don't have to explain to me because I've been around a long time, and I know exactly what you're talking about.
No,
it's nothing new.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what it is. Like, it changes. You know, it's you send out this and you do that and then a notary. But is the notary going to be able to write you a check? Or is the notary going to be able to give you anything that will hold? Okay, so you hold them in default, then what? Then you do everything outside of the court system?
No, you like, take it to the court then. My understanding, information.
Yeah.
You use your documentation and proof of non-response. You present that into the court, and the court from there, you know, once they put they're in default, then the court can enter a judgment in for you.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, you know, brother, go ahead and run that course, man, and let me know if you send in a notarial process and you go to the court and the court can be like, yep, you did everything right. We're going to hold them in default. Okay? If that works for you, please come back to my show and let me know. But as far as your question, I don't subscribe to that way of doing things because But by the time I do all that stuff you talking about with the notary, I can do the same thing in court and accomplish the same thing and not have to do that and go to the court and do it all over again. The court allows you to default somebody that doesn't answer. The court allows the court, the man who can write your order, which can be cast into a check, okay? He does that himself. So it seems like you're duplicating effort by doing a notarial process, then going to the court and have the court determine whether the notarial process was correct. And then the court might look at your documentation and be like, well, I understand that you sent them this letter, and I understand they didn't answer, but I'm looking at the stuff that you have in this letter, the content of it. I wouldn't answer that shit either. Excuse my language. I wouldn't answer that either. Where did you get that from? So isn't it best that you just go there with a proper pleading,
okay,
with a proper drafted complaint and say, Judge, they violated this, that, and that law is da-da-da-da, and the law says that they're liable under that.